For April 18th, 2023. With that, I'd like to call the meeting to order and move on to item two, Pledge of Allegiance. I'd like to ask if Director Colley would kindly stand and lead us in the pledge tonight. Sorry.
Please raise your right hand over your heart and follow me.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America. And to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you, Director Colley. We can now move on to announcements for tonight's meeting. This meeting is being conducted in person at the Rio Vista Water Treatment Plant Boardroom. As a convenience to the public, members of the public may also participate virtually by logging into the agency's Zoom meeting. Any member of the public may listen to the meeting or make comments to the board using the call-in number or Zoom webinar link. In the event there is a disruption of service which prevents the agency from broadcasting the meeting to members of the public using either the call-in option or internet-based service, this meeting will not be postponed or rescheduled, but will continue without remote participation. The remote participation option is being provided as a convenience to the public and is not required. Members of the public are welcome to attend the meeting in person. To participate in public comment from your computer, tablet, or smartphone, when I announce the agenda item you wish to speak on, click the raise hand feature in Zoom. You will be notified when it is your turn to speak. Please unmute when requested. To participate in public comment via phone, when I announce the agenda item you wish to speak on, dial *9 to raise your hand. When it is your turn to speak, dial *6 to unmute. We do have a number of members of the public present tonight, so I'd like to remind those in attendance that there is a public comment card on the table outside the boardroom. If you wish to make public comment on any item tonight, please fill one out and return it to the board secretary to help expedite the public comments. The procedure for tonight's meetings are as follows. I will introduce each agenda item. Staff will present. I will ask for public comments. I will then ask for discussion and questions from board members. Please raise your hand. Once concluded, I will ask for a motion and a second. After any further discussion, the board secretary will call for roll call votes. All directors are present for tonight's meeting except Director Cooper. We now will continue with the meeting and move on to item three, public comments. Members of the public may comment as to items within the subject matter jurisdiction of the agency that are not on the agenda at this time. We ask that members of the public wishing to comment on items that are listed on this agenda do so at the time each item is considered. I do not have any public comment cards. Madam Secretary, do we have any public comments on items not covered by this agenda?
We do not.
President Cooper, we do have a public comment.
President Martin, looks like Mr. Dunn has.
We do. Mr. Dunn, please come to the podium. And in the future, if you could complete a public comment card, that would help us. Thank you.
I apologize. I didn't put that one down because it was important to get the other one down. But anyway, the subject tonight I've had before, of course, is the recycled water that this agency has chosen to dump in the river and go out to the ocean for 30 years. And 30 years ago, I think about that time, the state of California issued a mandate to all public water agencies, which was your CLWA at the time, that if you have recycled water, you must use it. And that was 30 years ago. And the only time you used a little was for a private corporation outside the city for a golf course and the home landscaping. And yet, right now, during our drought, which, of course, is temporarily interrupted, it's against the rules of the law, et cetera, to use drinking water on the medians. But that's what you have going on here. Drinking water is used on the medians. Drinking water is used in Central Park, I was going to call it baseball, Central Park, and it has two ag wells that would cost in power maybe $150 an acre foot, but you charge the city of Santa Clarita $1,000 an acre foot, and the wells sit there doing nothing. So these kind of items are going on that I think are very easy to correct, and I'd like to see you correct it. We pay a fortune to bring water here, to process water here. Then we pay a fortune for the sand districts to process our water, and it comes out, and it's going in the river and out in the ocean, being saved for a project west of here that'll be a separate city from us. And yet these people in this city will continually pay the high cost of recycling the water, and they'll continually get it. There's something wrong with this picture. I'd like to see us doing things for our community here, especially if the community here is contributing the time and the effort and the money, which they have to. They don't have a choice, but we don't get to use it. Our drinking water is being used up. And at the same time, a growth is 25,000 homes just like that. Where's the water coming from? Oh, well, you're only going to get the water two times a week on your yard. And the house that you bought has 100 acre feet per year use. That's the way we bought it. If you start infringing on that, you're really damaging us. You're in a position of maybe liability. So the new houses, yes, maybe they're built and landscaped for less water and less than 100 acre foot a year. That'd be fine, but that doesn't apply to the older houses. So I think this is interesting information that you people should have, and you can very easily correct it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Dunn. Seeing no further public comment on item 3, we can move on to approval of the agenda. Are there any changes, additions, or modifications to the agenda from the?
I just wanted to make a comment, if we could, just so that the public isn't misled. While it is true that water that could be recycled is dumped into the river, we are not the legal authority that causes that to happen. As a matter of fact, we have worked pretty diligently to try to not put more recyclable water into the river. So I just think that is important for the public to understand that we would like very much to recover some of that water and are prevented by others from doing so.
Very good. All right, we were on agenda item 4. Are there any changes, additions, or modifications to the agenda from the board? Seeing none, the agenda is hereby approved. We move on to item 5, consent calendar. There are two items on the consent calendar tonight. One is approval of the minutes for the August 4th, 2023 Santa Clarita Valley Water Agency regular board of directors meeting, and approval of adopting resolutions approving and accepting negotiated exchange property tax revenues resulting from annexation Santa Clarita Valley Sanitation District numbers SCV 1122, SCV 1123, SCV 1124, and SCV 1128. Before we consider this at the board, do we have any public comments on item 5?
We do not. We do not.
Very good. Any questions or discussions from the board on the consent calendar?
I move the recommended action.
Motion by Vice President Gutzeit to approve the consent calendar. Do we have a second?
I'll second it.
Second by Director Marks. Madam Secretary, please call the roll.
As I call your name, please state how you vote. Director Braunstein.
I wasn't here last meeting, so I can't really vote on the minutes, but I would like to vote yes on the other part.
Director Peterson.
Yes.
Director Armitage.
Yes.
Director Cawley.
Yes.
Director Marks.
Yes.
Vice President Gutzeit.
Yes.
Vice President Wazowski.
Yes.
President Martin.
Yes.
Thank you. The consent calendar is approved, and that includes resolution numbers SCV-342, SCV-343, SCV-344, and SCV-345.
Thank you, Bora. We can move on to item 6, action items for approval. And before I go into announce item 6.1, if the general manager has any general comments before we launch into action item approval, you're welcome.
No, I think we can proceed. You have the designated staff presenters for 6.1 and 6.2.
Very good. We okay. do.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Stone. Move on to item 6.1, authorize the chief engineer to execute water service agreements with the Los Angeles Residential Community and Royce Lillio Valley, LLC. Presenter tonight is Brett Payne. Mr. Payne.
Good evening, directors. I'm Brett Payne, principal engineer for SCV Water. Hope everyone's doing well. The purpose of this evening's presentation is to seek your approval to execute two consolidation and water service agreements for two small community water systems here in the Valley, the Los Angeles Residential Community, or what we call LARC, and Lily of the Valley Mobile Village. I also wanted to introduce two people that have been part of the team and have helped champion this effort. Lawrence Sanchez with the State Water Board. He's the state's project manager and has been part of the application process since its inception back in 2015. So going on 8 years now. And then also Sarah Foley with BBK. She's been involved for the past couple of years and has been instrumental in setting up the financing agreement and helping to craft the water service agreements with both LARC and Lily of the Valley. So they're both dialed in on Zoom tonight and can be available for questions at the end of the presentation. So next slide, please, April. So this map shows the location and scope of the project. You've seen it before. We will consolidate two communities into our system. Lily of the Valley is located on the lower left of the map, and LARC is located on the upper right, both in the purple hatching. The red zone shows our SCV Water Catella pressure zone that we'll be connecting to in order to serve these communities. We will construct a 12-inch ductile iron pipeline that will go from Shadow Valley Lane near the city limits, and it'll extend about 1¾ miles up to the LARC community, which is just north of Vasquez Canyon Road. We will install master meters in front of each community. Those communities will continue to own, operate, and maintain their on-site distribution systems. And then also, due to the elevation rise along the Bouquet Canyon Road, the project includes an on-site pump station on the LARC property that once it's constructed, LARC will own and operate that. So next slide, please. I'll start with just a brief background on the financing agreement that's gotten us to this point. We submitted a grant application back in 2021, and the State Water Board, thanks to Lawrence's help, approved and then issued us a financing agreement that provides grant for the project. And I'll mention just a few key elements of the agreement. First, we are required to execute these water service agreements. That's a key first step, and we execute that with each community in order to spell out the terms and conditions for service. Each water service agreement is to be signed by SCV Water and the respective party, either LARC or Lily of the Valley. A second element speaks to how we bid the project. So the state grant will cover the cost of an 8-inch pipeline, which was determined to be the size needed to serve LARC and Lily of the Valley only. SCV Water has decided to upsize the 12-inch to a 12-inch so that other existing residences with private wells can also connect to the pipeline. SCV Water will fund the difference in cost between the 8-inch and the 12-inch pipelines. And because of this, the financing agreement requires that we issue two sets of pipeline plans and bid schedules. One will be for the 8-inch pipeline, which will serve as a basis for the grant funding reimbursement, and one for the 12-inch pipeline, which should be the basis for the marginal upcharge that will be paid for by SCV Water out of our capital improvement funds. And if the bids for the 8-inch pipeline exceed the approved grant funds, then we'll seek an amendment from the state for additional grant funds to cover that extra cost. Next slide, please. So I'd like to highlight just a few key elements of the water service agreements that we brought to you tonight. A key element is, as we said, that we'll be providing service through master meters in front of each property. And as stated in the water service agreements, each community will continue to own, operate, and maintain their on-site systems. Another key element relates to the consolidation itself. So Lark and Lily of the Valley both currently have domestic water supply permits that they will surrender as they become part of our SCB water system. And I might just add that I do understand that they're both looking very much forward to surrendering those permits, as it certainly lessens their burden for all the regulatory requirements that that we know go with a water supply permit. The water service agreements also specify that they will disconnect their wells from the potable distribution system, but they may continue to use those wells for on-site irrigation in a separate non-potable system with no cross connections. And SCB water staff will witness the disconnection of those wells to verify that. And then finally, the water service agreements outline the process to address cost contingencies during bidding and construction. Next slide, please, April. So project funds will come from the grant and our CIP. And here's the numbers. The grant for $3.9 million is intended to cover all project-related costs for the 8-inch pipeline, as well as the on-site pump station. And it'll cover planning, design, construction, and construction management. So all the way through the, you know, from the start to the end. Our CIP will cover the marginal cost increase from the 8-inch to 12-inch ductile iron pipe. And since we anticipate construction to start this fall, we've budgeted $1.5 million in our upcoming fiscal year 23-24 CIP, pending board approval. Next slide, please. So the next steps in the project will be to execute the water service agreements. And I'm happy to report that both Lark and Lily of the Valley have reviewed and signed, and these are in your packet. And so we're coming to you tonight for authorization to execute these, basically to hold up our end of the bargain. I'm also happy to report that about 2 hours ago, we received the DDW approval of the pipeline plans. So we're thankful for that. We're preparing bid packages for the pipeline and are working closely with the state to make sure that we have all the latest conditions that are associated with the grant as required in the financing agreement. Once we have bid documents approved by the state and our legal counsel, then we'll be able to advertise for bids, and we're anticipating that to occur this summer. Once we receive the bids, we prepare a final budget worksheet for the State Water Board's approval. Lawrence will review that, and then we'll, and at that time, we'll seek board approval to award construction of the pipeline. Also at that time, we'll have results of the bid. So if we can also advise if we'll be needing to seek an amendment to the grant to cover the full cost of the 8-inch pipeline. I might add also that we're going to have a separate bid package for the on-site pump station. We have approved plans. We're just working through the final throes of the permitting process with LA County, and we hope to have a final permit from LA County Building and Safety for the on-site pump station next month in May. And then final slide, please. So the recommendation is simple. Engineering and Operations Committee recommends that the Board of Directors authorize the Chief Engineer to execute and deliver the water service agreements with the Los Angeles Residential Community and Royce Lily of the Valley. And with that, I'd also like to just once again like to acknowledge Sarah Foley with BBK and Lawrence Sanchez with the State Water Board, because I certainly could not have accomplished this milestone without their help all along the way. So thank you guys. And with that, it's back to you, President Martin.
Thank you, Brent. Excellent presentation, and I agree. A lot of gratitude to all of our team put this together to get us to this point. We have public comment cards. That I would like to invite the commenters to come forward on item 6.1, and then we will open it up to online public comment. The first one is Roy Morrison. If you would come to the podium and make public comment.
Good evening. My name is Roy Morrison. I've been a property owner in Bouquet Canyon for 49 years now. And everything has been going well. I and a bunch of our neighbors are complete supporters of Lark Ranch. We're actually, we'd help them do things. So Lark Ranch is A number one. The property I own happens to be right across the street from Lily the Valley. Now, I've read over the memorandum, and it's primarily 90% on Lark Ranch. And there doesn't seem very, very much except the original titling of Lily the Valley. And I'm not against Lily the Valley, but I need to find out why they're not being included that much into the memorandum. For example, different details like what is our cost to hook up to it. We have a lot of controls in Lily the Valley, but it doesn't seem like there's much in the way of controls of, a lot of controls on Lark Ranch, but not to this that many as far as Lily the Valley. And I'm also wondering, if we're putting in a pipeline, are we going to put stub connectors in, I don't know what the exact word is, into the pipeline for existing property owners to be able to connect without having to do a lot of major repairs if we should need it? I also have a question of what is the cost for other property owners in other than Lark Ranch and Lily the Valley to connect up in the future to the pipeline? As you know, we're all on a water well system, and the water wells has gone down quite a bit. So luckily, hopefully, we're going to be up there. So these are the questions I have on it right now, and hopefully the board can answer it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Morrison. Brent, would you like to take a stab at responding to Mr. Morrison's comments? There's a number in his public comments.
Certainly. Lawrence and Sarah can chime in as need be, or Courtney. But we did upsize the pipeline. And thank you for your comment, Mr. Morrison. We did upsize the pipeline in order to allow individual residences along the pipeline route to connect. So we're actually in the process. Originally, we didn't think that would be covered by the grant, but we've recently been working with Lawrence Sanchez, and they've offered to fund the cost for residences to connect to the pipeline. So we're actually in the process right now of we've got a map and a list of addresses that we're just doing the validation of residential along the route. Our plans actually show the lot lines for the different properties. So we do have a final approved plans, but we're planning to add an addendum to the plans before we issue it for bids that would call out line items for the individual services and meters, and so that we'll know what those costs are, and then in turn Lawrence can give us the final approval on that grant addition, but we are planning. We're just now getting to this milestone with the water service agreements, so we are planning to do a public outreach here with our public outreach folks over the next month or two to basically coordinate with you on that, you know, what we're offering on that part. So we're making allowances for that. So, or making provisions for that, I should say, because we recognize the plight of the various landowners, you know, that are relying on wells that aren't doing so well. So, and we've talked to several folks along the pipeline route. So we'll engage with you. You can have my contact information. We're happy to follow up with you on that. And then as far as Lily of the Valley, so the water service agreements are pretty much, we did some negotiation on the, and went through an extensive legal review. And so Sarah Foley and Lawrence Sanchez were both involved in that. So that we tried to be very consistent with the two water service agreements. And so the grant, both, and I might just add, so LARC is a severely disadvantaged community with their water system, public water system. And then Lily of the Valley is a disadvantaged community with a public water system. So both were entitled to funding under the grant. So both are, will be providing the laterals and the master meters leading up to their property. And then both LARC and Lily of the Valley will continue to be responsible for the on-site operation and maintenance. And Lily of the Valley will also be required to pay for any on-site piping work that's required. So hopefully it's kind of there's a lot of details there. I hope it wasn't too much, but that's the answer. And I'll open it if Lawrence or Sarah want to add anything.
Thank you, Brent. Thank you, Mr. Marson, for your comments and questions. Next one up on comment on item 6.1, Mr. Dunn, could you come to the podium and make your public comment on item 6.1?
Well, good evening again. I've been expecting this to come because there's been such a stall on fixing the creek that's holding up everybody's water supply and not getting the water to their properties, to their riparian rights. And I see in the agreement here that they have to disconnect from their permits. It doesn't say they have to disconnect from their riparian rights, which were set in brass in 1918. Now, if you're telling them or requiring them to give up the riparian rights, are you compensating with about $200,000? That's about what it's worth. And the track I live in, Kaufman and Broad, wouldn't let us have the riparian rights. They kept it for themselves. That's the way property is. And it's a very valuable right. And you're saying, we're not going to let you feed your wells, and now we're going to sell you water. Now, this sometimes it looks a little bit off color, or like everybody's pulled together to keep the stream cut off long enough to say, oh, we need a pipe. And so what else would be done? Well, gee, we do go to Mars and with landers, and we go to the moon with men. And we got some dirt and rocks that washed into the stream, and we can't repair that. We can't fix that in 24 hours or 3 days. It looks like there was a purpose for keeping the stream running at a very, very low rate. I'm saying get the stream going, and they get the alternative. They can use your pipe or they can use their wells. I don't believe that you can shut them off from their riparian rights. Because that's really something that can't be tampered with. And I think you need to look into that. It's not a good deal. And, we haven't had a good deal since SEV took over the public, our New Hall County public water outfit. We were in good shape. We were efficient. We had no debt. You can't say that. You're borrowing money all the time. So I think you need to take a close look at it. You can't have the riparian rights, and you can't stop them from using them. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Dunn.
I can speak to that one also if you want, President Martin.
Hold on. Mr. Stone, would you like you or any of your staff to respond in any way to Mr. Dunn's comments?
Yeah, I think Brent was going to comment on the state requirements for the grant. So there is some back and forth on that. I think he can describe.
Very good. Thank you.
So
ask Director Colley, wait a minute, who's talking?
Lynchburg.
Drew.
Brent, could you go? Sorry, it got a little close. Brent, can you? Sorry to those at home who just had to do that. Could you explain the state's position on the need to no longer use the well in exchange for getting the connection to the public water system?
Yes. So there's a couple of points here. One, the state's primary, you know, one of the state's objectives is public health and safety. And so struggling water systems that are relying on water supply wells, private wells that are declining, you know, that is a threat to their supply. So by providing water to these disadvantaged communities, that they're able to have a reliable water supply. So that's number one. But then number two is that we're not, this is a non-adjudicated basin. There's no particular rights to it, but they do own the property, obviously. And so we're not making them relinquish or give up their wells. What we are doing is asking them to disconnect it from the public water supply system, the distribution system. But what this will do is allow them, and they've indicated that they would, you know, may want to use that for landscape irrigation, as long as in a separate system. So by connecting to the SCV water supply for primary domestic use, this will actually maybe help them, you know, recover the wells for use on landscape irrigation, which is also, you know, helps with sort of conservation of water and things like that too. So.
Thank you, Brent. Director Colley, can you hold your comment until we hear the last of the public comments? And as soon as we get into discussion, we'll entertain your comment. All right, we have one more public comment card from Roger Herring. Mr. Herring, could you come to the podium? Make your comment.
Good evening, SCV Water Board people of Bouquet Canyon who may be listening in. I just wanted to bring to the attention that the ongoing water issues in the watersheds of the Santa Clarita Valley, especially ones like Bouquet Canyon, have been going on for a long time. And it seems like there's always a large scale fix to these very complicated problems. That is, look for big projects and also big grant funds to solve the problem. But I also think that as some of the other comments were made earlier, that looking for more simple approaches to solve the problems of water is also needed. And so I just would like to bring to the public opinion, as well as to the board, that we can solve these water problems a variety of ways. The big scale solve or solution is a valid one, but also is a small scale, and the fact that the area's vast majority of the area has been under drought conditions for maybe a decade, that has been not addressed. And I'm sure that there are people who are concerned about that. And I'd also like to just make one other point and comment about this, because for decades, we've always heard that there's concern for endangered species up there. Is there any concern that by bringing water up to this upper watershed area, the water that's released then into the properties that are going to use that water, and then, of course, there's wastewater, will that have any effect on the endangered species, specifically like chlorine or other disinfectants that might be used in the water? There is supposedly federally endangered species, and I'm just wondering if that's a concern. So, and that's my comment.
Thank you, Mr. Herring. Brent, could you just one more time, just kind of briefly review what the project has done in the way of environmental clearances?
So We did have to work through the California Environmental Quality Act process and come up with documentation that basically confirmed no significant impacts. I would need to go back and review the details of that as far as endangered species and that sort of thing, but I'm pretty sure that I'd like to go back and research that one just a little bit before I do a final answer. It's been a little while since I've looked at that one.
Thank you, Brent.
All right. I have no further public comment cards. April, do we have anybody online who would like to comment on item 6.1?
We do not.
Very good. Director Colley, we can open up to board comment discussion. Please proceed.
All right. I just wanted to go back to the first speaker. I believe he asked a pretty specific question that didn't really get an answer. And I want to make sure that the public understands. The question was costs to hook up to the system. And I believe that a property owner along this pipeline would need to pay a facility capacity fee generally in order to hook up to that system, which is not a trivial amount of money. And I just wouldn't want us to gloss over that fact and leave anyone with the impression that hooking in is low cost or free in general. If I'm incorrect, please somebody correct me. All right. And then the only other, I'll make a real quick comment in case I'm, hang on. Let me get that corrected if I'm wrong.
Okay. Yes. And what Brent was pointing out and what he was discussing is we are working with the state to, in fact, make it so the state would cover the cost of not only the connection fee for the lateral and meter, but the capacity fee as well. You are correct that if they don't take advantage of this state opportunity and they wish to connect at a later date, they will have to pay for the lateral installation, meter installation, and full capacity fees. Rough approximated cost would be about $20,000.
Perfect. I'm sure the public that's listening appreciates that clarification. That's important. And the only other thing, I'm obviously hugely supportive of this. I'm glad to see that it's making some progress. I wish that we were able to move quicker. To the homeowners that don't connect, I would say that even if you do not connect to this system, there would still be an advantage in that there would then be fewer straws, if you will, into that watershed and leaving more water available for those that do not connect, that still have wells. And so there's a net advantage, I think, for pretty much everyone in the in that particular area. Thank you.
Vice President Gutsai.
I want to ask Courtney if he can clarify that state covering the fee issue, was that before everyone along the pipeline, or did you mean to be talking about Lark and Lily of the Valley?
Yeah, it's it definitely for Lark and Lily of the Valley. We have the agreements here before you to do that. Mm-hmm. But the state has also mentioned that other residents along that community could do a very similar agreement, and we'd be reaching out to them on the individual property basis. We're not looking for growth or anything else. We're just looking for those who already have a home and would like to connect and come off of their wells from domestic supply.
That's amazing. Thank you. And I had a couple other quick questions. I mean, this whole process is amazing. I am very grateful for our staff for figuring out a solution to this issue after so many years, and very grateful we found the right people at the state to help us. The presentation was a very good summary, again, of something that's gone over many years. So good refresher. I appreciate that we include some ability for the residents in the area to participate in this. As I mentioned at the Bouquet Creek project, I mean, I'm very familiar with the area. I used to bike ride up there a lot, and I know that they need help in that area. as far as the Bouquet Creek project, LA County is leading that. And I think it's going to take a while. They're pretty optimistic, but I would say 10 years at best. And in my calculation, that's not an official number, but this is going to be a much faster solution for everyone. And with that, I thank you guys for doing this. It's exciting to see it come into fruition.
Thank you, Vice President Goodside. Director Marks.
Yeah, for the benefit of the public that are here, that's here, maybe we could have Assistant General Manager go give a real brief description of why the flows in the along the creek have diminished and what the timeline of process is for restoring those flows.
Steve, go ahead.
Be happy to do that. Thank you, Director Marks. And yes, so let's see if I can be brief. It has been a long history. So basically, the issue in that canyon has to deal going back to a fire and then a subsequent very rainy year in about 2005 that inundated the creek with debris. And that debris now prevents water from flowing freely down the canyon. The water that flows down the canyon historically is through an agreement that was executed between the Department of Water and Power, LADWP, and the predecessor to United Water Conservation District. And this original agreement goes back to when the dam was originally placed in the canyon, and it was meant to ensure that the flows that historically had flowed down the creek would continue to flow down the creek. Because of the lack of the ability of the creek to handle the flows, it causes a pretty significant safety issue in the canyon, in that the water, if you were to release it at the amounts that the agreement specifies, ends up flowing onto the roadway and causes some pretty significant roadway issues and safety issues. That has been the case for since around 2007-08, when those flows haven't been released through the canyon at levels that they should be. And so there is a lot of effort that is trying to move forward with a solution. It is challenging because of the regulatory environment in the Endangered Species Act. And so the solution that is being proposed by LA County Public Works, as Director Gutzeit mentioned, they are the lead for the project, is a solution that would remove the debris from the creek, reestablish the creek, reestablish the environmental habitat in the creek, as well as roadway improvements. And that's where that stands. There is a working group that is currently working on it. The most recent activity is that a Wildlife Conservation Board grant has been applied for to help facilitate that project move forward. So I think I'll stop there. That was probably not brief, but stop there.
Perfect. Thank you.
Yeah, Mr. Bunn, I was going to ask if we were getting too far off base of the item that's before the board tonight, you would let us know.
I will do that, but so far I think you're okay.
Thank you. All right. Director Armitage.
Thank you. So thank you to Mr. Payne for the presentation, and thank you to the commenters. It's always good to hear public comments, so I appreciate the questions and the comments that were made. We've been talking about this issue on and off for a while now, so I too am glad to see it making its way forward down the path to the project happening. Because as was alluded to earlier, it helps provide water to two particularly disadvantaged communities in our valley with the use of grant funds, which is fantastic. And then it also makes us eligible for other low-cost funding options for other projects that we have to be spending money on anyhow. So it's a win-win-win all around. My only comment is just while reading the agreements that were attachments A and B in our packets, I wanted to say that I appreciate that the agency seems protected from incurring overage costs. I just wanted us to be careful and sensitive to overage costs that could potentially be pushed on to Lark Ranch and Lily of the Valley. And so I'm sure that staff will do that, but I just wanted to put that out there and make sure we're not putting any additional financial burden on them as well, as best as possible. I know sometimes costs change as you go through a project, but I just want us to be sensitive to that. Thank you.
Thank you, Director Armitage. Director Bronstein.
So thank you to Mr. Payne as well for that presentation. That was really great. And I too am looking forward, have been looking forward to this project. So that's I'm excited that we're moving forward. So most of my questions already have been asked. However, I was curious just because of the language. Are we requesting that people that join, that private properties that will want to join the pipeline, are we requesting that they also forgo their well rights as well?
Yeah, Brent, if you don't mind, I'll go ahead and take this one as well. We're not asking them to give up their well rights. We are just not allowing them to connect their well to the same system that serves domestic water. So their well can be used for irrigation on site, just like Lily of the Valley or Lark, but they have to not use that well for the domestic and tie the two together. And they will be required to have a backflow device to protect the system too, just to make sure that's clear.
Thank you, Mr. Mayo. Any other comments or questions, Vice President Ozahusky?
I'd like a motion to move forward with this authorization.
Director Peterson will second that.
Director Peters seconds it. We have a motion and a second, but before we call the vote, I would like to also add my words thanking the entire team that's been involved in this project from many years back. It's been an effort to try to get this done, and now it seems like it's been a long time, but here we are, right? This is the major step in the direction of getting this accomplished, and we appreciate everything that SCD Water team has done, the owners of the property and our resource agencies and our funding agencies came together to make this a successful venture, and it's much appreciated. With that, Madam Secretary, please call the roll.
President Martin, there is one person online that has a public comment. Did you want to take that public comment?
Yes, indeed.
Ellen, if you would like to do your public comment, please go ahead and start.
Hello?
Go ahead.
Hi, I don't know if you guys can hear me.
We can hear you.
Okay, hi, this is Helen. I live like a half a mile after Lark Ranch. So actually it's been like a few years we're having a difficulty with water. All my plants dry out. So we had to buy water a few times, actually more than a few times. So I was wondering, since you guys doing the pipeline into Lark Ranch, is any possibility we can also have the water too?
Is that your completion of your comment and question?
Yes.
Very good. I think this item was covered, and I think that they will be inviting landowners to connect. If I'm not... Please go ahead and respond to that, Brent or Mr. Cole. I don't know.
Yeah, we may have to follow up one-on-one with you on that one, depending on where you're located. You say you're beyond the Lark Ranch to the north?
Yeah, we're like a half a mile after Lark Ranch.
Yeah, that's my mistake. We're not going beyond Lark Ranch.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll have to we'll have to work with you one on one on that one. That falls outside the purview right now of the project. But depending on how close it is, there might be, you know, we can discuss it with you. So. And I'm Brent Payne, the principal engineer at SCB Water. So feel free to reach out to me.
Very good. Let's move on. We do have the motion, the second, and no further discussion, no further public comments. Madam Secretary, please call the roll.
As I call your name, please state how you vote. Director Bronstein.
Yes.
Director Marks.
Yes.
Director Peterson.
Yes.
Director Armitage.
Yes.
Director Colley.
Yes.
Vice President Ozahosky.
Yes.
Vice President Gutzeit.
Yes.
President Martin.
Yes.
Thank you. This item does pass.
Thank you very much, Board. Thank you, staff. Thank you, members of the public. We can move on to item 6.2, approve a ratepayer assistance pilot program. Presenter tonight is Rochelle Patterson. Ms. Patterson.
Good evening. We just have a few slides to go over the pilot program that is in your packet. So in 1996, a constitutional amendment was approved called Proposition 218. And Proposition 218 requires a connection between water rates and the costs of providing that water. So as a public water agency, we are prohibited to use revenues generated by water rates to launch or expand an assistance program. These agencies need to use non-rate revenues, such as property taxes, rental income, communication, lease revenues, donated funds, or funds from other programs to fund an assistance program. Next slide. So, sorry for the small print. This was kind of the process history. So this discussion started more than a year ago when we started looking at the ratepayer assistance program, but was put on hold pending the decision of, at that time, Senate Bill 222. The California legislature was considering Senate Bill 222, which was introduced by Senator Dodd, which would have established a water rate assistance program and water rate assistance fund to provide water affordability assistance for drinking and wastewater services to low-income ratepayers. Although SB 222 passed at the end of the session, Governor Newsom vetoed the bill because there was no funding identified and because it would create an ongoing program that would require all community water systems and water systems and wastewater systems to participate and would result in significant general fund pressures in the billions of dollars to provide such assistance. Also around that time, the agency registered and became part of the LEWAP program, which is the Low Income Household Water Assistance Program, in April of 2022, and began promoting the program through direct outreach, bill inserts, and on our website. This is a federally funded program administered by the state, designed to provide financial assistance to low-income Californians to help manage their residential water utility costs. This program has had numerous revisions and now offers a maximum of $15,000 per qualifying household for those customers that are past due on their water bills and $2,000 for eligible customers that are current on their water bills but are seeking assistance. This is a limited program with an expiration date of August 2023, unless extended by the state. So with the veto of SB 222 and no current approved legislation that I know of, looking at the discussion of the agency's program was revisited. Next slide. So staff was tasked to research other public agencies to see if they had an adopted low-income or ratepayer assistance program and what their process was. Staff started with contacting our benchmark agencies, to find out if those agencies had had a program. 8 of our 10 benchmark agencies are retail agencies, and of those 8, 3 offered some type of monthly assistance. There were also 6 other public agencies that we found around the state that offer monthly assistance, as shown in attachment 1 in your packet on page 133. The amount of monthly assistance and the program eligibility vary by agency, but as shown in the attachment, it appeared that about a $10 credit to a fixed charge was a more common target used for that assistance. Next slide. So when we were first started to look at the assistance and what the impact would be to the agency, we looked to see about how many families in Santa Clarita that may fall below the poverty level that may qualify for some type of low income program. So according to the Santa Clarita Economic Development Corporation, in 2022, 7.3% or 21,807 families of the Santa Clarita Valley out of a population of almost 300,000 lie below the poverty level. And assuming 4 residents per water account, so that 21,807 divided by 4, that would be 5,452 accounts. Assuming an assistance of $10 off the monthly fixed charge for each of those customers, the annual cost would be about $654,000 per year. An alternative would be to fix the annual allocation to the program as not all low-income families are responsible to pay their individual water bill. Next slide. So where would the funding come from? So for this agency's program, we would use non-rate revenues. We could use the 1% property tax or sell or lease or rental income. Currently, our non-rate revenues are used to offset the need for higher rates for all customers. Funding would ultimately reduce the PAYGO budget until a new cost of service study and new rates were adopted. And just as a refresher of how our rates and our budget work, we start with revenues from all sources. We subtract our expenses from those revenues. We subtract our debt service. If we have any reserve funding, and then whatever is left over goes to PAYGO. So any amounts that would fund this program would ultimately come out of the PAYGO budget. Next slide. So after receiving the updated report in February of this year of the study that was presented, the committee was then tasked by staff to establish criteria for a program to move forward. So those guidelines that we were seeking were, you know, if we still, after receiving the report, if there was still interest in pursuing further development of the ratepayer assistance program, what the desired monthly amount of assistance per account would be. Was that $10 a good number? Should it be something else? Eligibility criteria, what amount of funds would be desired to provide for the program on an annual basis? Knowing that we would need to use non-rate revenue sources, or that wait and see approach to see if some other legislation was introduced that could take its place. But in the end, the committee had recommended that staff develop a pilot program of 3 years with limited funding until alternatives were developed, either legislation or maybe a donation. Next slide. So the pilot program was developed. The recommended guidelines were that we would use the SoCal Edison and SoCal Gas CARE program to determine income eligibility. We would, if we were to limit it to $100,000, which is in the pilot program, we would have priority, and the priority group would be seniors over the age of 62, veterans, and permanently disabled that were part of that CARE program. Only residential individually metered accounts of 1 inch or less would be eligible. Require that the eligibility account, either the gas or Edison account, be in the same name or service address as the SCV water account holder. and require that account holders to requalify each fiscal year, and that we would allocate $100,000 per year from non-rate revenues, and those would be approved annually through the budget process. The pilot program would run for 3 years with an effective date of July of 2023 and expiring June of 2026. And just the quick calculation, for example, if the agency budgeted $100,000 annually for ratepayer assistance, the first 833 eligible customers could receive a $10 credit per month to their fixed charge in ratepayer assistance. If more than 833 customers applied, we could use a lottery system to select those first 833 customers that fell in that first group. Additional criteria could be used, to prioritize, a second group if the first group did not fill all those 833 eligible accounts. Next slide. We also looked at program funding alternatives. So researching other methods to offset the ratepayer assistance program expense without impacting our current customers. We do currently have some existing agency functionality. If a customer, we would have to turn this on. It is not currently there, but it is available to us. We could do direct donations. So we could add a button to our a link to our website for direct donations. We can round up for those customers that pay by credit card. It's not over the phone. It would only be those customers paying online with their credit card to round up. And that is through currently our invoice cloud. That's the system, the credit card processor that we currently use for all of our water accounts. There are other fundraising platforms like the Donate Kindly, GoFundMe, and there's some others. We're currently researching and looking for the best option. So if and when the donation platform becomes operational, those donations can offset the agency funding. And then we could have more on this, alternative as it comes up. But we want to make sure that if we do offer these this donation platform, that we want to make sure the cost to the agency isn't very high because those would offset. So if we have a donation, those costs would lower the donation, but we want to make sure that it's the best value. So we will be doing some more research on that. Also wanted to note that this process is not new. The Valencia Water Division and our customer care manager, Kathleen Wilson, prior to the acquisition of Valencia Water Company as a PUC regulated utility, private water companies were required to have a low income program. So the procedures and application were updated with this pilot policy and criteria, and an application was created and is ready to go. And that's on page 139 of your packet. And then next slide is a recommendation that the Finance Administration Committee recommends that the Board of Directors approve a ratepayer assistance pilot program. And that completes my report.
Thank you, Ms. Patterson. We have a number of public comment cards that we've received before we go on to other written comments that we've received through the website. I'd like to have Mr. Jeff Staple come to the podium to make your public comment.
Good evening. My name is Jeff Stabile, and I work with the Santa Clarita Veterans Services Collaborative. The economic impact has hit everybody, but especially hits veterans that are on a fixed income. We measure the number of people that come into our Veterans Center, and since 21, when we reopened after the pandemic, we have about 110% increase in the number of people walking through the door. Right now, 45 to 50% of them come in for the food bank. That is a big increase from what we were doing before. It is extremely important for veterans that are on a fixed income to get some assistance. So my reason for being here is just to encourage you to approve this program and assist this veteran community. Okay, thank you. Yes.
Could you please stay by the microphone? Mr. Stabile, thank you for your service and thank you for your service to the veterans. The veterans that come for the food bank, can you let me know, do they live in an apartment complex, a assistant senior living center, or a residential household?
Right now, we don't collect that data. When they come in, they sign in, give their name, their email, telephone number, and the reason they're coming in. We don't ask them about their income or what their living arrangement is right now. We kind of feel uncomfortable trying to pull that material, their information from them, because a lot of veterans and their families are kind of embarrassed that they have to come in and use the food bank.
Totally understandable. Yeah. But your general feel, because it's kind of important for this right here program.
I would say probably half of them have their own home. Others will probably live in certain lower income apartment complexes or condos. We don't see many that come in from the senior center that are there, because they get a lot of assistance from the senior center.
Okay. Understood. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you, President Barton.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Stable, for your comment and for your service. Ms. Noltemeyer, can you come to the podium for your public comment?
Pam Noltemeyer. Yes, I was been following this, and I don't think it's something you really need to get into. There are so many programs that are available to people that are having trouble. And we have so many people coming over constantly from another country into our country. And that is mounting every single day. Now, if you want to start something like this, be aware that you will be paying for thousands and thousands of people. I've been watching this program, you, all of you. I don't remember voting for any of you that I can recall. I don't know how it was formed. And when I see things like this coming up, do you really realize, you know, you're in California and you're right next to a foreign country that is just letting them come in by the thousands? Maybe that's not of your concern, but think about it when you start a program like this. Is it really needed in our community? There are so many in the past. I mean, this has been a problem for years, but I've seen prior people sitting up here that have always handled it by helping him, saying, well, we'll let you pay it off slowly, or you have some very good employees. And you might want to ask them what they feel about you doing this before you grant it. Because, like I say, I am very confused about how the systems are working here lately. And I don't know if you really have looked into with your employees that are doing it now. Have you asked their opinion, what they feel about this? Or is just something where you're out there to get voted back in or whatever. I can't remember where I voted for any of you except maybe you. Because it just hasn't been there as far as I can see. So
thank you, Ms. Noltemeyer, for your comment.
Yeah, bye-bye.
Our next public comment card is from an old friend, Lynn Planbeck. Ms. Planbeck, can you come to the podium?
Lynn Planbeck, I wanted to thank the Finance Committee committee members for their hard work on this and for finding a way to bring it to the board for at least a pilot program. When the board acquired Valencia Water Company, there were 3,500 ratepayers on the PUC assistance program. And those, of course, not only were knocked off the program, but their rates were increased. Valencia, most of all, when the merger happened. So I think this is a really important program. I think it doesn't cover that area, so I hope eventually it'll get extended. And I would like to say that the same thing happened with Santa Clarita Water Company as well. When that one was acquired, which was maybe 20 years ago, that Santa Clarita also had that rate program. This is something that's going to be really helpful for folks, as Mr. Stabile said, that are on fixed income, not just veterans, folks that are on disability or have other financial issues. So I really appreciate the board doing this. And I would like to make the suggestion that one of the things that I noticed on the Edison bill is there used to be a box that you could check where you could add an addition to your bill to help someone that was having trouble with winter water, winter gas rates or winter electric rates. And before you go do a GoFundMe site, maybe that's something you could add to the bill if you're thinking of other ways to fund this. But thank you very much for considering it, and I urge you to pass it. Thank you.
Thank you, Lynn.
Real quick, can I ask her to repeat that number? I'm sorry, Lynn, could you repeat? You said Valencia.
Valencia had 3,500. We went through this. Kathy Martin went through this. This information is available to you. I don't know how much was on Santa Clarita Water Company because we didn't ask her for that when it came through the outreach committee. But Kathy Martin can get you those figures, I'm sure, because that's one of the things we looked at is how many people were on previously and how it was determined by the Public Utility Commission to have those people be allowed to get rate assistance.
Okay, I just want to make sure I didn't miss here. There was 3,500 folks in our rate area. Thank you.
Mr. Stone.
Sure. Just for clarity, I think there could be a couple different numbers in the mix here. One may be the estimated number of households that are below the threshold for the poverty level or for the qualification level for low income rate assistance by public utilities that are PUC regulated. That number has been put out there. My understanding is the actual enrollment in the Valencia program was less than that because it requires re-enrollment from time to time, and it would require that low-income resident is also a ratepayer and not perhaps resident in an apartment or another living situation where they wouldn't be a ratepayer. I think Rochelle has statistics on that. If you're interested, she whispered them in my ear. So it looks like Kathleen has real statistics. Here we go. I got it. She handed it to me.
There's a small story around that.
Okay, so go ahead with the story.
Yeah. There was a peak. So back, I think, around 2011, 2010, the PUC had required that anyone that was enrolled in the Edison or the gas company care program was automatically enrolled into the water company LIBRA program at that time. So there was a peak, but you could see that it dropped off towards the end. Before the acquisition, it was about 700 customers, but prior to that automatic enrollment, it averaged about 350 a year.
So the peak was just under 2,300. For about a three-year period, there was a little over 2,000 enrollees. And then when that was discontinued and required re-enrollment, it dropped down to about 1,000 and then down to about 700. So, you know, I just want to be accurate, but point taken, and I think that was one of the considerations with the pilot, was to try to find a total budget that was manageable and that the board could have some discretionary control over from year to year. If the board ultimately were to adopt this, they would be in the position to consider whether to increase that amount or decrease it from year to year after the pilot period. Yeah.
Thank you, Matt. Before we entertain any public comment that might be online, I'm going to go through some of the comments that we received in writing to the agency website or to the board secretary. Couple of letters, and then I will just acknowledge other members of the public who have submitted a brief message of support. These two letters I will read to you. They give you a good feeling for how the community might feel about this measure. This first one comes from Kevin McDonald. Many of us know Kevin McDonald as the chief executive officer for the Santa Clara Valley Senior Center and the Committee on Aging. His letter reads as follows. Dear board members, on behalf of the Santa Clarita Valley Committee on Aging, and then in parentheses, SCV Senior Center, we support the proposal to establish a ratepayer assistance pilot program for low-income individuals, specifically for seniors, people with disabilities, and veterans who fall below the poverty level. We applaud the efforts of the Santa Clarita Valley Water Agency to provide assistance to vulnerable citizens in the Santa Clarita Valley. The SCV Senior Center staff see firsthand the needs of our seniors who have fallen on hard times. Most of the services we offer provide free of charge, are provided free of charge as a result of our fundraising efforts. We even have a special senior assistance fund that supports seniors in crisis, which is funded through our celebrity waiter dinner. There are many seniors, veterans, and people with disabilities who fall below the poverty line. This pilot project will show that the SCV Water Agency sees a critical need and is taking action to support our most vulnerable individuals. We fully support the pilot project and look forward to working with you in the future to meet the needs of our community. Sincerely, Kevin McDonald, Chief Executive Officer. Second letter I would like to read tonight is from Dr. Jean Dorio and Robin Clow. The subject of the letter is Ratepayer Assistance Pilot Program, SCD Water Board Meeting Agenda Item 6.2. Dear SCD Water Board, we write in support of a Ratepayer Assistance Pilot Program for the Santa Clarita Valley. As senior advocates, we personally see older adults struggling to pay utility bills, including water. This past winter, many of our low-income residents have had to make difficult decisions, especially with gas and electricity. Forgotten, probably because of this winter's rainy weather, has been the impact on our water usage. Like others during the drought, many seniors were asked to cut back, and they have done their due diligence to abide by these requests. Since personal budgets have been markedly affected by other utility bills, usage of water has lessened for fear of further impacting their pocketbooks. Having a ratepayer assistance pilot program will help identify this forgotten population and assist others facing similar financial problems and decision making. The need in our valley is much higher than we think. And ultimately, this program will prevent those who might be financially threatened to still maintain their quality of life. As members of the SCV Water Board, we hope you will consider voting for the Ratepayer Assistance Pilot Program, which will benefit many older adults in our community. Thank you, Robin Clow and Jean Dorio, MD. Now, we also received a number of brief letters of support, emails of support, and I'll just read you who they came from. We got a brief letter of support from John Paladin of Valencia, California, simply wanting us to vote yes to approve item 6.2. We received another brief letter of support from Suzanne Rizzo, also of Valencia, asking us to approve this measure. Another letter of support came from Steve Cassell, I believe is the way it's pronounced. Let's see, it might be all right. Another letter of support from a Bridgeport resident, Dr. Randy Martin, no relation, by the way. Another letter of support from Catherine Franti of Saugus. Brief message of support. Another brief message of support from another friend of the agency, Sandra Cattell. Letter of support, brief letter of support from Elliot Bronwine of Newhall. And finally, a brief letter message of support from Lynn Winner of Castaic. Oops, I may have one more. I did. One more from Sherry Gilmore, letter of support. Madam Secretary, do we have any other public comments online?
We do. Just one moment. Diane Troutman, you may begin your public comment. Diane, did you still have a public comment? You may begin.
Okay, there we go. Got it. That unmuted. Sorry about that. My name is Diane Troutman, and I agree with what Kevin McDonald has written and Dr. Dorio and Robin Clow. I've been working on senior issues and Jeff Stabile as well. Senior issues and housing issues as a member of the Housing Committee for the Homelessness Task Force that the city founded. And I can tell you that there are a lot of people who are just a few dollars away from losing everything. So any kind of assistance that we can offer is important. And I think that this pilot ratepayer assistance program is well-structured for now, but I would certainly like to see pursuit of some other options. I think it was mentioned that you would maybe allow people to add additional donations through their bills or bill payment, or as Lynn suggested, a checkbox to add to the form. And I think that those are good ideas, but I wouldn't make them a replacement for the funding, but rather supplement so that you can cover more people. And hopefully by tracking this carefully over the 3-year pilot program period, you'll see where the need is and work to encourage other options from the state, perhaps, because I think this is something we're going to need going forward because of some economic trouble that people are going through. So I do urge you to support this, and I think that it's a really important goal for you to have as an agency. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Troutman. Are there any other members of the public online who wish to comment, April?
There is not.
Very good. We can open up for board discussion, questions, comments. Director Armitage.
Thank you. So first of all, thank you, Ms. Patterson, for your presentation. And again, thank you to all the commenters. It's really nice to hear public comment, and I really appreciate the time that everybody took to provide comment today and the letters that were sent in. I want to start by saying I think it's really important to reemphasize that it would have been ideal to have Senate Bill 222 pass, which would have created the state-administered and state-funded program for water utility assistance. So it would remove the burden from individual agencies having to all go through this process for those who do choose to do a ratepayer assistance program. So that would have been the ideal and preferred method. And I, you know, as mentioned before, we patiently sat back and kind of watched that bill go through the legislative process last year. And I know I personally was disappointed when the governor vetoed that. So it put us back at square one for this discussion again. From what I'm hearing in public outreach and legislation, there is some interest by Senator Dodd to reintroduce this similar type of legislation this legislative year. But honestly, I don't see it going anywhere in a deficit year. Last year we had a surplus year. And so I'm not holding out any hope that it's going to go anywhere this year. So I do think it's appropriate for us to start this conversation back up again. I want to say that the LEWAP, the low income assistance program that is currently offered by the state, it's great, but it does have limitations, including the fact that it is going to sunset in August. So it's August is going to come before we know it. So I appreciate the consideration of this program being considered as a pilot with a cap on the budget for now, or I think it should always have a cap on the budget. So that we can learn, so that the agency can get a sense of what is the demand, how much interest is there from our community members in this. And then we adjust, right? We collect data, we're gonna get data on this, and then we adjust as we go. And I really appreciate the focus of this pilot project being proposed on the community members who are likely on a fixed income. So we've talked about the low-income seniors, the low-income veterans, and the low-income permanently disabled. Having been part of the ongoing budget discussions that we've been having and seeing the rate forecasting show that rates will only probably continue to increase, I think it's really important to remember that some families will be able to absorb this increase just fine. But for others, it may be a difficulty. And so, you know, we might sit here and go, well, it's $10 off of somebody's bill, but you know, it's cumulative. So it might be $10 off their water bill, but they also qualify for maybe $20 off their gas bill and then $20 off their electrical bill. So that can be a significant amount of money that makes a huge difference to certain families. So I just want us to keep that in mind as well. And then I want to thank staff for all of the information that you gathered to bring this proposal forward to us to help us make an informed decision and decide whether or not the agency wants to do this. I think it was very helpful to see how other agencies have chosen to help their low-income community members and ratepayers. And I think it's important to see that other agencies have made that decision and that commitment to their community to provide assistance to customers who may be struggling. I do like the idea also, it's that has been mentioned many times, of setting up a fund that people can choose to donate to. I think the Roundup thing is so easy to do. And given the number of customers we have, could accumulate a significant amount of money. So I like exploring all the different avenues potentially going forward to help with these costs in a donation format as well. So I am supportive of trying this out as presented by staff and adapting it as we go and we learn from the process. And again, I appreciate all the comments that were provided by our fellow community members today. Thank you.
Director Colley.
So I am a veteran. I am disabled, and I'm also a senior citizen, albeit I'm not 100% disabled veteran. One of my children is. So 100% disabled veteran starts with compensation from the federal government that starts at a little over, I believe, $3,000 a month. That's not a fixed income, that is fully indexed for inflation generally. But certainly if you were to try to live on 3,000 and a little bit in this valley, you might struggle a little bit. My difficulty with this is that it actually, as designed, I don't think it does what we intended or what we think it's going to do. So our people that receive water from us, I think generally would fall into two classes. Those that have a meter into a single residence of some kind, which is the target of this program. There are others that receive water through some kind of a master meter or a larger meter that serves multiple residences. Anyone receiving water through a master meter would not be able to benefit from this program whatsoever. I suggest that folks who generally have lower incomes generally are more likely to receive their water through a master meter. For example, we just talked about in the previous item, a park where everyone in that park receives their water from a master meter. And those residents would pay fully for their water. Okay. There would be no assistance, and they would in fact be required to help fund this assistance for folks that lived perhaps in a single family home, perhaps someone who lives in a home significantly nicer by most people's standards than the one they live in. And so the way this is designed, it will cause rates to be higher for some folks that have lower incomes in order to help augment, pay for a water bill for those who are not as less fortunate as they are. And so were we to design a program that was to take money from those who are more affluent and give it to the least affluent, I might be a little more supportive. But this program simply fails to do that. And when I think about it, I think it'd be very, very difficult to design a program that actually, for us locally, to do that. So there are many programs that do help folks. You know, like I said, I'm a disabled veteran, and I'm extremely appreciative of the entire population of the United States helping to pay for some of the health impacts that I suffered from serving my country. And I am very, very appreciative of the general population that feels like it is appropriate for me to be compensated for those injuries. But this program isn't anything like that. And I think it's something we ought to not do, because it simply does the opposite of what we think we ought to do. Thank you.
Vice President Ozahusky.
Yeah, I agree with Director Colley on this one. But before I make my final comments, Ms. Patterson, I have a few questions for you. Can you come up? Intentions of the programs are good, but we want to make sure the program works. Ms. Patterson, you mentioned that we have received 5 payments from the low-income household water assistance program. Were those 5 payments for 5 different accounts?
Yes.
Okay. And then according to Santa Clarita Economic Development Corporation, in 2022, it is calculated that Santa Clarita Valley has 5,452 accounts that meet the low income poverty level. My question for the staff would be is, what would be considered by staff as low participation if the possible maximum is 5,452 accounts?
That was just a calculation based on the number of customers or the number of population that would fall below the poverty level based on the Economic Development Corporation. It's not based on if they live in a house or an apartment. It's just based on a number that they say that our population is below the poverty level. We just had to do a calculation divided by 4, a family of 4, right, into the population to get a number of accounts in our service area that may fall, that may be low income, fall below that poverty level. It was just a simple calculation.
Okay. And to echo Director Colley, this program assumes that all customers eligible for this program are responsible for paying their water bill. So this excludes long-term RV parks, apartment complexes, and any assisted living centers. Is that right,
Patterson? Yes, that is correct. Although I will caveat that, you know, the Valencia system, they did have some participation. So there were customers that were eligible for the CARE program, which were eligible for the CARE program that also were eligible for the LIBRA program through Valencia. So it may not capture all of the low income that we would want to help, but it will capture some.
Understood. Looking at the April 4th board meeting packet, and this has been a continuing process by the finance department. SCV Water works with all customers to avoid this connection for non-payment by through amortization agreements, and that's extended for 12 months. There were 1,878 accounts subject to disconnection in February of this year. Of those, 485 remained overdue with 1 week of their scheduled shut-off date and subsequently received one or more courtesy reminder calls. And for that month, a total of 119 accounts remained unresolved by their scheduled shut-off date and were disconnected for non-payment. For that month, the 119 accounts that were shut off, do we know how many of those would meet the eligibility criteria under their CARE program?
I don't think we have those demographics. Did you not?
When we do courtesy phone calls with ratepayers who are about to have their water shut off, what were some of the discussions between our operators and the ratepayers generally?
Defer to Kathleen if she knows.
The courtesy robocalls or the courtesy calls that we send out are robocalls.
So no staff interaction with the ratepayer?
Not for the three courtesy calls that are going out.
Is there a courtesy phone call up that's been given by our staff with the ratepayer at any point in time?
Not typically.
Okay.
During COVID and up through, I would say, until probably late of 22, we were doing verbal outreach. After that, we replaced it with the robocalls, the automated calls.
And question to both of you, what would you consider a success rate with the amortization program? 100% participation, 50% participation? How would you validate that process?
Well, when it comes to avoiding disconnect, it would be 100% participation. A significant portion of those, unfortunately, end up breaking their installment plans at some future point, at which time the cycle begins again. We did conduct some targeted outreach. We started at the end of January. We're actually continuing it. We identified customers who had received multiple shutoffs since we resumed shutoffs last spring. And a small group of customer service reps sat down, and we worked on talking points so that we could design practical strategies that were customized to each one of those accounts, utilizing technology or, recommending the LIWAP program, whether they were financial, practical, technical. Some folks say that they don't receive their bills, so we would recommend maybe paperless billing. So we did do targeted outreach to that small group, but we're still kind of tracking those efforts, and we're still working on those efforts with them. So I would say when you have a customer who has been disconnected for non-payment or the threat of disconnection exists for non-payment, the likelihood that they're going to sign an amortization agreement is very high, because that is one of their only means by which to keep their water on or reconnected. Once their re-entered into the cycle, the shutoff cycle, and or at some point they break their amortization agreement by missing an installment, they re-enter that cycle again. And customer care works very diligently with them. We've extended well beyond what our policy states in terms of one amortization per year. We've been working with our customers that are on their fourth amortization this year. So we're working with them as closely as we possibly can. But unfortunately, they are not able to sometimes meet their bills and meet their payments.
Understood. And when working with those ratepayers, there's two sets of rates here. There's the variable rate and the static rate. Would you say the variable rate overshadows the static rate for those particular customers? Or is it pretty consistent once the ratepayer goes into amortization agreement with SCV Water?
Yeah, we don't differentiate. We're looking at total bill.
Total bill.
Yeah, total bill.
Okay, understood. I think the intentions of this program is good, and SB 222 was good, but just like Director Colley said, I don't think it captures what we really want to the people that we really want to help. I would like to see more of an effort on pursuing functions like GoFundMe or Donate Kindly, and regarding those efforts, Ms. Patterson, when will the F&A committee hear anything about those sort of processes that we can implement?
We've just started doing some research and gathering costs. We do know there's some programs out there, but there's probably other, and we just want to make sure that the program works. One of the platforms we looked at, their website's been down for a while, so that's not promising either. So we do want to make sure that their program works and it's cost effective. We just started working on it this last week for the other programs to try to get costs. So potentially in the next month or so, we would have some data for the F&A committee.
And does the F&A committee and staff, just like Director Crawley suggested, working on the way to address members of SCV of Santa Clara Valley who live below the poverty level, but they do not directly pay the water bill, meaning in an apartment complex or hooked up to a master meter? Is there are we working on finding out the best way to address those once removed ratepayers?
Yeah, I just, most of those are either companies or some type of HOA where they pay the HOA or the company pays the bill, and then they allocate a certain percentage to each of those homeowners. I don't know that we have a program or a program hasn't been developed to look at those multifamily residential customers.
Okay, understood. Thank you. Thank you to you both.
Vice President Gutzak, go ahead.
Thank you.
Yeah, we did talk about this extensively at F&A. I do have one question that wasn't answered yet, and I know you spoke about experience at Valencia Water in the past. Do we know that the administrative cost, so per customer, how much would, if we spend $100,000 a year going towards $10 a month for people, is there an additional cost component that would hit our budget as far as, maybe we need to do more calls, maybe we're going to run newspaper ads? What is the additional administrative cost on top of the $100,000 a year proposed pilot? Do we have an estimate, ballpark? Any experience with that?
Right. I don't have any numbers. I can't tell you staff time would be minimal. The process would be relatively automated. Besides the staff time associated with processing the applications and validating them, you're really looking at postage for, three mail pieces per customer per year. And then as far as the outreach and the campaigning, the marketing aspect, we're looking at utilizing just sort of leveraging existing pieces. So we were looking at doing things like bill messages, envelope snipes, a bill insert, which is actually relatively inexpensive to insert it because it's piggybacking the postage that's associated with the bill, mm-hmm. and then a website exposure.
Okay. And just to clarify, when you said three mail pieces to each customer in the whole valley, that's a lot of mail. That's a lot of this problem within 100,000 right there.
So I should clarify that would be three mail pieces per participant.
Okay. Thank you.
Sorry about that.
Yeah. So. Thank you. That's much more affordable. That was my main question for staff that I didn't get answered before, but you know, I'm conflicted with this. I think, you know, I'll offer that, you know, as a family where both of us have to work, we work like crazy. We're half crazy all the time. Everyone needs help with their bills these days, I think is my thought process. I was just reading that in the country, California was the lowest, well, it was the 50th state in terms of personal income growth. So we were nearly the bottom state in income growth. In fact, our income for 2022 was less than the inflation rate, meaning Californians are falling behind on their income. And this really troubles me that how hard it is to live in California. I do appreciate all the comments. I was on the Senior Center board and know how hard our seniors have it, and many people have it worse than the average person. So there is there's difficult and crazy that many of us experience, and then there's dire straits. And I feel that I like the idea of a pilot program. I would like to investigate how this would all work and, you know, find out more about the administrative costs, the participation rate. I certainly do hope that there would be either donations or possibly grant funding or other means to fund this rather than funding that in the end would come from all of our ratepayers. However, $100,000 a year is a fraction of a percent of our $129.7 million annual budget. And also being on FNA, I know we deal with a lot of big numbers. I've personally commented that we need to be very careful with costs, and government sometimes doesn't acknowledge how much, you know, your dollars per hour costs are. Things are always $500,000 here, $1 million there. And I feel like we don't take that seriously enough. So in the end, I think we could easily find $100,000 from some more efficiency at sharpening our pencils on many of our large projects. So I'd like to move the recommended action of the $100,000 per year, 3-year pilot program.
All right. We do have a motion, but before
I was going to second, but I would like to comment as well.
Well, go ahead, Director Burlington, make your comment.
So first of all, I want to thank staff that have been working on this for a really long time. And I really, really appreciate all the thought and effort that went into this. So thank you guys so much. Secondly, I would like to thank everyone that took the time and effort to comment on this. Reading some of these comments, it strikes a nerve. I mean, I'm sure it did for all of us. And I want to remind everybody that this is a pilot program. I mean, it's not a perfect program. It's not, you know, the ideal thing, but it's a point that we can start at, and then we can shift as we go, as we see what the need is, as we see how we can pivot maybe to explore other classes, other connections, other ways of revenue, donations. All these things are great, but they won't help us if we don't start somewhere. And that's why I think that this pilot program is extremely, extremely important. I'd like to piggyback off of what Director Gutzeit said about the amount of money. It's $100,000. That is a lot of money. I'm not gonna poo-poo it. But I was wondering, what is the amount of money that the general manager has a discretion about spending without bringing it to the board?
$100,000.
So I would like to point that out, that it is a number that we trust people to be able to spend without the board's input. And I'm sure that it probably happens once or twice that our general manager uses his discretion to approve something. I really, really urge all of us to think about this. This is a good starting point. And I really hope that we can take this and we can, you know, help it evolve so it becomes the project that we all want to see happen.
Thank you, Director Bronstein. Director Peterson.
As the chairman of the finance committee, we've had a number of discussions about this. I spent some time discussing it, and the staff has done a fantastic job of providing us the information to, move this to the full board for discussion. And this discussion is good. You know, one of the reasons why I was in favor of it was, as the previous directors have said, is it's a pilot program, but it also gives the opportunity, since I've had experience working with the CPUC care programs previous to my time here, is that it provides an opportunity for the staff to work with the customers to give them a little bit of reprieve for the ones that are having difficulties out there. I think that helps a lot for the staff's abilities to take on those difficult job of talking to those customers that have problems with their paying their water bill. So with that, I think Director Bronstein, you second the motion, but I'm in favor of the motion. Thank you,
Director Peterson. Director Marks.
I have a question and clarification. When staff went out and did the survey of other agencies that were implementing the programs, how most of them addressed this through a fixed charge. Did any of the agency, maybe like LADWP, try to address the issue that Director Colley brought up of those behind a master meter?
In my interviews with each of the agencies, there wasn't one program that was for multifamily residential. I only saw the program for residentially metered accounts, not multifamily.
Right.
I guess while I'm sympathetic with Director Colley's concern about many of the people who maybe would benefit by this project the most, who we might prefer to target. I find it telling that we don't see anybody who's figured out how to do that yet. And maybe that's something that we can work on. But in the meantime, I think this is a good start.
Mr. President, Michelle, could I comment on Director Marks? Could I comment on his comment? I, you know, you just struck a nerve that I thought of something. I don't know that it's an exact match, but I will point out that one thing that the agency has been doing in recent years is a pretty aggressive outreach to multifamily projects for retrofit. We have our CII apartment complex retrofit program, which goes into entire complexes, installs high efficiency fixtures, doesn't site audit. We are trying to also move in the direction with landscaping on sited apartments. So because it is an indirect target to get to those customers, helping the entire complex use less water should have some benefits in terms of lower commodity uptake, commodity rate costs for those customers. So it isn't a one for one. And when I first moved here, I was a non-low income apartment resident, and it was frustrating to see how they broke out the rates, you know, per unit. They certainly didn't measure my use.
Right.
But if the overall use goes down, the overall cost that they're apportioning out should go down as well. I'll just note that.
Thank you.
Okay. Question for you, Ms. Patterson. How many water service retail connections do we have in round number?
Nearly 75,000.
75,000?
Yes.
All right. So if we, and those 75,000 customers, the $100,000, I agree with Director Colley, that comes out of a pot of money that goes to pay for water service in the Santa Clara Valley. And to the extent that that would no longer go to water service across the valley, it would mean that some customers will pay somewhat more. So if you have 75,000 customers and they, so let's say they contribute $100,000 towards this, which is essentially what they're doing, that's less than that's a little more than a dollar a year. Is that correct?
Per customer.
Okay. Right. And then the dollar a year spread over 12 months is pennies, yeah, basically. So I just want to put it in perspective. And I agree with Director Colley. I mean, we had a former director who I appreciated the way he summarized this. A subsidy is a subsidy. Any subsidy is going to cause all of our ratepayers to pay more than they otherwise would if you subsidize one group. And I agree with that. That's, in an absolute sense, you're correct, Director Colley. In a practical sense, this is not a lot of, let's say, pennies to ask from the ratepayers who can otherwise afford to pay it. And I think the only way we're going to find out, it is not, as Director Brownstein said, it's not a perfect, I don't think there's a perfect answer to this. But in order to learn how to make it better or to whether to continue or not, I think the pilot program is a worthy effort in that direction. And I think the Finance Committee has put in an awful lot of work, as has staff, in support of the Finance Committee to come up with something that, that we can pay for without a major impact to our rate base. And so with that, I will be supporting this. And Director Colley, go ahead.
Yeah, I've heard over the last 20 years on this board many, many, many times the argument that what we're talking about right now is just a small amount of money, and so it really doesn't matter. I've heard folks say that there are folks on fixed incomes or in dire straits. I think that was a term used by one director, where small amounts of money really matter. And so the dollar or so that you're talking about collecting comes at times from folks when in dire straits. And I would repeat the argument that in general, the folks that are more likely to be more poor are behind master meters, and folks that are more affluent, like probably most of us here on this dais, we have single family homes generally, and we have a meter, and we pay our water bill ourselves. We don't pay it indirectly. So we have no ability to print money. This is not money that is going to come from anywhere but ratepayers. And were we not to spend it, it would not be collected from ratepayers, including ratepayers behind master meters. So to say it's not perfect is a gross understatement, actually. It actually inverts. It actually hurts people who are behind the master meters, who are more likely to be more destitute. And it gives to folks who are less destitute. And so to stand this thing on its head and say it's not perfect is somewhat ridiculous in my view. I think that we ought to be considering the alternatives that were mentioned, things like allowing customers to willingly donate, so that those of us that are plenty affluent could donate. And I would love to see a program where our customer assistance folks on the phone with a person that has fallen on hard times would have some kind of a pot of money that they could, at their discretion, provide some assistance, you know, because they're the ones talking to this customer, and they would have the ability to really understand the need. But this program, again, it's actually the opposite of what I think we are intending to do. So we ought not to proceed with it. We ought to consider some alternatives.
Thank you, Director Colley. I'll make one more comment, and then we'll call for the vote. The way the program is set up, and you have to qualify for the $10 reduction. In order, that has to be an individual meter, not a master meter.
That is correct.
And you have to fall within the income levels that defines them as disadvantaged, or whatever the term is. Is that correct?
That's part of the CARE program.
Okay. So, and the numbers you calculate are well beyond the number that could all receive the benefit. And so those that do receive the benefit will qualify on those two counts, individual meter and be below the poverty level.
Correct.
Correct?
Yes.
So to the extent that it's a program that accomplishes what we're looking for, I think it more accomplishes it than doesn't accomplish it. I think a dollar a year for some people that perhaps or on a master meter is less significant than $10 a month for those that do qualify. So I think it's just a matter of putting in perspective, and I will definitely support this. Madam Secretary, will you please call the roll?
Director,
Mr. Chisholm.
Okay.
Before you call the roll, we have one more comment. Director Armitage.
Thank you. I just wanted to point out that Palmdale Water District, I follow their social media because I think they do a really good job with their social media. And I've noticed 2 years in a row that they opened up their ratepayer assistance programs, I think in January. And within, I think, a couple of months, I'll see a post saying our applications are now closed because we filled our program. So I've been incredibly astonished at how quickly that they fill their the number of applicants that they can take for their ratepayer assistance program, and they actually allocate more than we do at $160,000. So I put that out there because I don't know that all of we're having a lot of discussion around assumptions, and I don't know that all of those assumptions are actually fully accurate. Some of it might be, some of it might not. But again, as has been pointed out many, many times, we're not going to know until we try it, until we actually gather our own data through a pilot process. So that's the last thing I'll say. Thank you.
Please call the roll.
As I call your name, please state how you vote.
Director Colley?
No.
Director Armitage?
Yes.
Director Peterson?
Yes.
Director Bronstein?
Yes.
Director Marks?
Yes.
Vice President Gutzeit?
Yes.
Vice President Orzechowski?
No.
President Martin?
Yes.
This item does pass. Thank you.
Thank you, Board. Thank you, staff. Let's move on to our next item. We have item 7, PFAS notification and update presentation, presented by our Director of Operations and Maintenance, Mike Alford, has been standing by to make this presentation. Mr. Alford. Good evening, everybody. Yeah, you want to stretch? All right, everybody stand up. Yes, stand up. Close your eyes. Take a deep breath. Inhale. And exhale. And lift your arms up. Director O, are you doing this to oppose me directly? Everybody needs to stretch. All right. That feels good. That feels good. Because the information I'm about to bring is a little dark. Dark Waters. Did everybody see that? That was a good movie. So we've been dealing with PFAS since about 2019. And I look around the room and most of the directors were not here in 2019. So in addition to the notification, we thought it would be appropriate to do a little bit of an update, kind of bring you a little more up to speed and just to remind you of where we were and where we're going. I'll try to be as concise and slow as I can, keeping within April's 20 minutes that she told me I had. But if you do have questions, since this is not an action item, if you have a question and you want to interrupt me, that's okay. You know, we don't have to wait, I don't think. Is that true, Mr. Bunn? Okay, good. Next slide, please. So the state and federal regulations, and it's not just our state, it's across the country, it's a moving target. There's a lot going on related to PFAS regulations. So just to give you sort of a brief update and history of what we've gone through here in the state of California, DDW, Division of Drinking Water, has had several notification and response levels. So those are regulations that lack for contaminants that lack a maximum contaminant level. So there's different rules associated with notification levels and response levels as opposed to a maximum contaminant level. The current notification and response level for PFOA, one of the main PFAS chemicals, and there's over 3,000, I think there might even be more than that. For PFOA, PFOA, it's 5.1 nanograms per liter or parts per trillion. The response level is 10 on a running annual average. So we collect samples from our wells quarterly and we do it on a running annual average to calculate that. So if you fall below the 10, at or below the 10, you're below the response level. If your running annual average is above that, then you're above it. For PFOS, the other one that is regulated currently in California, it's 6.5 nanograms per liter, and the running annual average response level is 40. There's additional things that I'll talk about later, but I wanted to kind of just talk about where we came from and where we are right now. It started I think it was 2016, where EPA, U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, had a health hazard advisory level of 70 combined for both PFOA and PFOS. So DDW started with that, and then they broke it up into individual ones and then came down to this is where they're at now. I thought it was appropriate to mention OEHA, Office of Environmental Health Hazard Assessment, because during the regulation process of maximum contaminant levels in California, DDW uses
the PHG that OEHA comes out with and tries to get it as close as possible, taking a lot of things into consideration, cost, prevalence, removal technology, analytical technology, things like that. So currently, OEHA has come out with public health goals, which are not enforceable, and they're set at the lowest, at the no observable health level. So it's that at that point, they say there's no potential health effects. And currently, the draft PHG for PFOA, PFOA, is 0.004 nanograms per liter. That's 0.004 of a part per trillion, of a nanogram, right? Or part per quadrillion. And right now, we could only, laboratory can only detect down to 2 parts per trillion nanograms per liter. So you can't even detect the 0.004. And then for PFOS, it's 1 nanogram per liter. The US EPA and the whole reason that we decided to do a full update, they came out with some draft maximum contaminant levels about a month ago. And so we've been scrambling internally, trying to figure out the impacts to this agency and our ratepayers as associated with these draft MCLs if they get promulgated. And I want to preface this, and I'll preface it throughout the entire presentation. Our numbers right now that we're looking at are draft, they're estimates, and they are subject to change. But I'll get into more into that as we move forward. Next slide, please, April. So when did we first detect these PFAS chemicals in our water? It was during the UCMR Unregulated Contaminant Monitoring Rule 3. So in 1996, they passed the second round of amendments to the Safe Drinking Water Act, they being the US EPA. And in that, they created this thing called the UCMR, which requires the EPA to look at approximately 30 emerging contaminants every 5 years and require water agencies to sample for those. So during round three in the 2013 to 2015 timeframe, we were sampling for PFAS chemicals and we had some detections. In 2019, Division of Drinking Water issued an order to our agency to sample 15 of our wells. Now we have upwards of 45 plus active wells. So why did they only choose 15? It was based on the results from the UCMR 3. If a well was within a mile of another well that had a detection, you would sample it. If a well was within a mile of a landfill, you would sample it. If a well was within a mile of an airport, you would sample it. So we don't have any airports around here, but those are the three criteria. So it was 15 wells. So we actually brought this to the board in May to notify them what was coming. We weren't sure what was going to happen. We had a little bit of data from a few wells from the UCMR, but we wanted to make sure that everybody was aware of what was potentially coming. So after the initial results came in from May, we realized that we were dealing with a fairly significant issue. And so we decided to sample all of our wells. And we've been sampling all of our wells since then. Without direction from DDW, we did it at a proactive approach. So after the May sampling, there was one well that exceeded the combined 70 health advisory level that the EPA had out, and we immediately shut that well down. That was the only well, and that was Valley Center, which is back online now with treatment. But initially, after Division of Drinking Water started ratcheting down and separating PFOA and PFOS into individual notification and response levels, we then started subsequently shutting wells off. And so initially there were 21 wells that were impacted. Currently there's 15 wells that are still offline. We've brought 4 wells back into service, the N wells, N, N7, and N8 with treatment and Valley Center. And we're knocking on the door of bringing back Q2. In fact, today's the 18th, right? Yeah, we had our DDW inspection for well Q2. And so we're organizing or setting up to load the resin into those vessels so we can get that well back online. Yes. Yes. Fantastic. And my boss, Keith Abercrombie, called me on that. there are some wells that are offline for other reasons, right? So we had 21 initially. A couple wells came back online that dropped below the response level. And there are also other wells that did not come back online because of mechanical issues as well. So that's why the math doesn't work. Right, exactly. And then two additional ones are expected to come online at the end of the year. That's currently under construction. Next slide, please. So now we'll move on to the public notifications. Now, generally, we wouldn't give a full presentation for the notification exceedance. We did initially, and then it's more routine. The public notification for notification levels requires us to send, to notify our governing bodies, to notify the board of directors, to send a letter to the city and send a letter to the county. And we'll do that right tomorrow, April, right? Okay, that's what I thought. But we're also adding an additional notification in this, and this was per advice of legal. And it's related to CERCLA, the Comprehensive Environmental Response Compensation Liability Act. Thank you. Dang it. It's been a while. So it requires community relations in removal actions to let the public know if we've exceeded something and we're going to do something to try and keep that well online. And so I will talk about that. And what it does, what requires is the actions that we're taking. If there's response to any inquiries, we respond to those and then provide information concerning the release, which at this time we don't know anything about where the PFAS chemicals are coming from. Next slide, please. So I'll go slow with this because there's a lot of information on here. The numbers with the asterisks, those were previously notified. And I'm going to scroll so I can see it a little up close. So I'll just start with well E15. It has a 6.7 level detection of PFOS. So that exceeds the 6.5. We have previously notified based on that. However, it's being also included in here because it now exceeds what's new is the PFHXS. So we're currently operating under new orders from DDW, which includes notification and response levels for PFHXS. And it was at 5.7. Yes. It is 20, which is interesting because generally it's supposed to be 10 times the notification level. I don't say it's supposed to be, but historically it has been. And that's what it says in the DDW regulations. And I'm not really sure why they brought that down just a bit, but we're well below that. E17, it doesn't have any PFOS. So if it's a blank cell, it's either below the detection limit or it's below the notification level. And then the rest of the wells you can see there. The only other one, there's a couple other ones I want to point out. W9 had a detection of 19 for PFOA, which is higher than the response level, but because the running annual average is below 10, the well is still online because it hasn't exceeded that that response level running annual average. And then the last column, I'm showing you which wells are online and which are offline. Mitchell 5B, for example, is offline because of mechanical issues. I think that's the only one, yeah. And then I also want to point out N13. It exceeded the response level for PFHXS. The line below that is what it says N13 blend. We actually have an approved blending plan to operate this well, and the actual blended value is 6.4. So it's well below the 20 response level, but it's above the 3 nanogram per liter notification level. And this is one I'll get in a little more detail, and I think it's actually the next slide. Yeah, for the 40 CFR notification requirement. Next slide, please. Oh, yes. Sorry.
You invited me to interrupt.
Yeah.
PFHXS, this is kind of new to me.
Yes.
Is this another PFAS new chemical. C8 chemical?
Yeah. So there's I think upwards of, it could be close to 6,000 PFAS chemicals, per and polyfluorinated alkyl substances. So it has the basic fluoride chain, right? And the S indicates it's a sulfonate or a sulfonic acid. The F is a, it's, that's the fluoride. The A, it, the O is the octane sulfonic acid, I think. Yes. And the S, I don't remember. You're testing my chemistry. I do have a minor in chemistry, but it's, you know, I've also had a recent head injury. So there could be that too. So yes, that it is a new regulated chemical by DDW. And EPA is also looking, and I'll get into that in a little bit too.
So can you tell us a little bit about where it might have been, why it was created and
what it's used? Yeah, that's a great question. And I probably should have had a general slide about that too. All PFAS related chemicals repel water, repel oil. And so firefighting foams have these chemicals in them. Teflon, which we all love. But now you'll notice if you go to the market and you'll see a new pan, it'll say PFOA free. So that means it doesn't have that chemical. It might have PFOS. It might have PFHXS or PFHXA or PFNA or, you know, the whole host of them. See, that's generally what they're used for. Yeah. Director Bronstein, yes.
Was the 19 value the most recent one?
Yes.
So, like,
we're really unsure why that was there. It's W9 is located off the San Francisco Creek. And it's the middle well of three W wells. W11 is the northern one, which is all well below, or not well below, but it's all below the detection limit. So we don't see it there. It is on the other side of the creek, but the creek's not that wide, and the creek generally doesn't flow much. And then W10, which is below it, is less than W9. So we're not really sure. We'll sample again in another quarter. We're also using a new method. So DDW, which, by the way, our lab just got, their application was accepted by ELAP, the Environmental Laboratory Accreditation Program. It just got accepted. And so we're hoping within a couple months, we'll have approval for us to run that new method, 533.
Wouldn't we want to, like, though, double check to make sure that the 19 wasn't a fluke or something? I mean, that's a high value and makes me personally nervous.
It is. And we are going to be sampling it again within a quarter. We didn't take a follow-up repeat sample. We did not.
We can do it tomorrow.
We can do a lot of things tomorrow. I think generally we accept the results as they come in. We generally follow the regulations as they're laid out. And if you start opening yourself up to doing things outside of what the regulations require you to do, it's a slippery slope. It's when do you stop? And so we feel confident that, you know, we're following the rules. It's below the response level running annual average. And if next quarter the level is high and it brings the running annual average above, we will shut it down. And just to follow up with that, we are not necessarily required to shut down just because you exceed a response level. So a response level is unlike a maximum contaminant level. If we needed to, or we chose to keep the well running, there'd be certain things we would have to do. We would have to notify every person in our air service area directly, as opposed to a public hearing like this. And there's other things we would have to follow. So, Director Armitage.
So similar concerns to what Director Bronstein mentioned. So my question is, if you're using a running average, it just concerns me that there's such long periods of time between your quarterly testing periods and to really determine whether or not something's truly an issue. So I guess a couple questions. Is that being blended?
Well, yes, indirectly. All of our wells and all of our water is blended, right? So there's very few customers that would get water directly off of a specific well. This well pumps into what we call zone 2A North. So whatever else is in that distribution system zone would be blending with whatever water was pumping into there as well, which would include import water, which would include well W10, which would include W11, as well as other sources.
Okay. Yeah. It's because I think that's my area. So I'm concerned for me and my neighbors in that area. It's just such a high value. I don't know. I don't have a proposed solution right now. I just waiting a whole quarter to test again is concerning to me.
Yeah. I mean, when OEHA and Division of Drinking Water and EPA come up with the regulations, it's a long process. And they take care into looking at potential health effects, acute versus chronic. They take into account the prevalence, where it's at. They take into account the levels. I mean, it started just 4 years ago at a combined 70 for PFOA and PFOS. It's difficult to say, you know, for us, at least in my perspective, to challenge the regulators on how they're coming up with what they're asking us to follow.
Yeah. I mean, I get it. This is like you said, it's a moving target and we're learning as we're going. So it is really difficult. And I understand that.
If I could jump in, the slippery slope that Mr. Alvord was talking about is in part a liability slope. Picture Mr. Alvord on the witness stand with a questioner who has access to all our data. So, Mr. Alvord, you tested for this one more than was required. Is that right? And you tested for this one more than was required. Is that right? And you tested for this one. Isn't this the one where one of your directors lives? More than was required. But this one that caused the problem, you did not test more than was required. Why did you do that? So something like that is what lawyers worry about a little bit.
Well, yeah, and I wasn't suggesting any special treatment because I brought up the issue by any means. I'm concerned for everybody in the valley. I'll just leave it at that for now. But thank you.
All right. Next slide, April. Sorry, you were getting up. So on the one that's related to CERCLA, well 13, as I mentioned, exceeds the PFHXS response level of 20 with a concentration of 23. So we looked at a variety of options, and I'll start from the bottom and move up because what we ended up choosing was the top option. We could have just removed the well from service, and we had the blending plan actually in place before we took this sample. Because we had a sample from 2019 that was above the 20. And so we assumed it was also going to fall above the 20. Now, we could have waited and said, you know, we're just going to wait and see what the next sample was, because we weren't required to sample for this well, and the notification and response levels for this well weren't started until this quarter, which was March when we started sampling, which is, you know, we had this sample from, I don't know, 2019 from before, and that was the only well that had this. And so we could have taken it out of service. We could have operated the well without blending and just continued running it. We could provide PFAS treatment to remove it, which we are intending to. We're currently in the planning stages of providing treatment for this well and potentially another well that's near it. Or we can purchase additional import water to blend the PFHXS levels below the RL. And that's what we decided to do. We decided to run the blending plan with, and it's actually not only blending with import water, it's blending with another well. But we have the option to just run it with import water to blend. We can't operate just the other well. It's not enough water. So you have to use some import water to do that.
Can I ask a question on that?
Yes.
Why does CERCLA apply to this situation and not the other ones? And this may be a question for you or for legal counsel. I mean, we have a bunch of different levels, none of which are at the MCL level yet, as far as having gone through the full regulatory process. So why does CERCLA
concerns apply to a response level, but not to public health goals, not the no observable effect level? Why CERCLA only on this one?
That's a great question, because we're not required to do any action over a notification level or over a PHG. We're just required to notify. This well exceeds a response level. Mm-hmm. So we're required to do some sort of action, either take it out of service, which DDW recommends.
Oh.
Provide written notification to every single customer, increase sampling. There's a variety of lists that you're required to do when you exceed a response level. And so we actually had to take an action for this.
But we're taking an action with the other ones as far as notifying government entities.
Yes, I guess that doesn't fall under that.
That's not enough action or something. Exactly, okay. Yeah. All right. But yeah. All right. That's a more, there's a reason.
Yeah.
And okay. Thank you.
Next slide, April. So this, we're now leaving the notification. We're going back to not the history, but where we currently are and then where we're going. So it's hang on. Sorry, April. I think this is going to take longer than 20 minutes. I wrote 2+ plants online. The plus is the Q2. So I was hoping we would have it online, but it'll be online by May. The N wells. Restored capacity is 6,250 gallons per minute. And that's what it can operate at. And it's dependent on the size of the vessel, how much resin's in the vessel. There's a number of factors that go into and how many vessels you have during design and construction and all of that. The construction cost for that was right around $9.6 million. So that's an actual hard cost that we know. So remember I mentioned earlier that there was some estimates and things. So we're using... And that's old hard costs. That's 2020 hard costs. 2023 hard costs are different, we're finding out, than they were in 2020. So bear with us on that. Valley Center has also been restored. It's 1,200 gallons per minute is the operational capacity of that one. And that's a hard cost also, right around $5.1 million. And Q2, you can see Q2 is similar in capacity than Valley Center. So Valley Center was put online last November. So 2022, Q2 was completed construction in 2020. So you can just see the difference in cost. Now, there's other costs associated with it, but it is an increased cost for Valley Center as compared to Q2. We currently have one plant under construction. That's the Hanbi Santa Clara, and that's being designed and constructed at 2,000 gallons a minute. And that, it has a construction bid cost of 9.6. So you can see the difference in what we got in 2020, which we were extremely proactive. And I want to acknowledge this, even though I'm going to delay the talk a little bit. But we worked as a team where we just became an agency a year and a half, 2 years roughly. No, it was about a year because it was the beginning of 2020. Engineers like to plan, they like to design, and then they like to construct. We did everything in parallel, and it was really an amazing feat, I think, that we got this up and running and built, designed, everything permitted within a year. So thank you, Courtney, for working with operations. We also have two additional plants in design, T7U4. Oh, there's a typo there. Dang it. T7U4 and U6. It has a design capacity of 3,000 gallons a minute, and the estimated construction cost is 14.2. It's estimated. That's what Orlando gave me, the engineering estimate. And then the S wells, which has a combined capacity of also 3,000, has an estimate around 12 million. Again, these numbers, they're going to move. And once we have final design plans and we go out to bid, the numbers will definitely change. So just keep that in mind. But we have to start somewhere. We have to use something. We can't just say we don't know what the costs are going to be. All right. So now we're going to shift. So this, all of this here that we're talking about was analyzed in a Kennedy Jenks report back in, I think it was 2019, the end of 2019, beginning of 2020. And what they did was, which was really good at the time, I was a little skeptical because I didn't know, thought we would need it. They looked at 80% of the response level. And they looked at every single well that was at least 80% of the response level and calculated cost estimates. Where I was just looking at, well, if it's the response level, we're going to treat it. If it's not, then we won't treat it. And little did I know, levels were coming down. So it was really insightful for them to do that for us. So a lot of these wells that we are in planning on and looking at have already been analyzed by our consultant for us. Then came March 14th, I think it was, or maybe it was 13th. US EPA came out with draft MCLs, which kind of surprised us. I mean, we knew something was coming out. We didn't know what it was going to be at. Generally, California is ahead of the feds. But the feds are also now behind Michigan, Massachusetts, and other eastern states. They already have adopted. I think New Jersey has an adopted MCL, and I think Massachusetts has them as well. And with US EPA MCLs, the state has to adopt what they put out. They can't go above it. They can go less. They can go more stringent, but they can't go above it. So EPA is projecting that they're going to adopt these draft MCLs by the end of this year. And the as I did a reminder here with the current NL and RLs for PFOA and PFOS, the draft MCL for both of these is 4 parts per trillion each. So this is it's below the current notification levels, but it's above the current detection level of 2. They also are putting a combined hazard index calculation for these other ones. So Director Colley, here you go. You got PFNA. Don't ask me what, I think the N probably has something to do with ammonia maybe, or nitrate or something. I don't know. Nitrogen. PFBS, PFHXS is in there. And then the Gen X ones, which is HFPO-DA. And the combined hazard index calculation for this takes a value that they set for each one of these individually, and you take your value, and if it's above it, or you divide the two, and then if they sum up to 1 or higher, then you've exceeded it. If they're below it, then you didn't exceed it. We don't currently, based on all the data we have any issues with PFNA, PFBS, or Gen X, but we have very limited data on Gen X. That's part of the UCMR5 that we're going to start sampling on. The PFHXS, we only have the 1 well that exceeds it. But we do have some wells that are sort of in the mid to high single digits that may cause some impact. But we're still analyzing that, and we have to look into it. So what we believe is that there's 11 additional wells that will come offline if these get adopted by the end of the calendar year, which is up to a supply of around 18,000 acre feet a year. Now, these numbers are moving targets, right? The supply, how we calculated it here, is taking the actual capacity or design capacity and multiplying it by 1440, dividing it by 325851, multiplying it by 365 to get your acre feet. So we just, it's like it's running 24/7. So it's an inflated number, but nonetheless, it is in here. And again, as I put in here, more precise supply impacts are under analysis. Next slide, please. So I already mentioned this, that the Kennedy-Jenks provided an initial cost analysis using 80% of the PFOA rule. And so the planning phase, there's 4 additional plants that are already in planning, but beyond the ones I've already talked about. So those really aren't impacted by this MCL, these draft MCL. The 4 new plants are the additional impacts as a result of the MCL. So even though 11 wells will come offline, most of those are already being planned or in some sort of design for treatment, where these new 4 ones would be impacted. And I have some rough costs here too on these. Again, it's either engineering estimates, it's taking current cost estimates, it's also including prior cost estimates and prior costs to calculate some of these. So the last slide really tries to summarize all of this. Next slide, please. So the restored capacity is the 8650. So that's the NWELS and Q2, which is coming online soon, and Valley Center. So that's we're considering that restored capacity. And that's how much they can pump. They can pump up to 8650 GPM, gallons per minute. The total cost for those, and those are pretty good numbers, is $17 million, right? It was that 9 point whatever, the 5.1 and the 2 point something. Now, the O&M costs we're looking at, Kennedy Jenks also analyzed the O&M costs, and they're pretty close to what we're actually seeing because they included things that maybe were slightly inflated in their estimates. We're seeing real costs because the big cost is the resin and the disposal of the resin. That is the driver. Yes, there's labor. Yes, there's power. Yes, there's additional chemicals. There's other things that there's pre-filters. All those are in these numbers, but the real driver is the resin. And you also approved a while ago, the end of last year, I think it was, for us to do a PFAS pilot, and we just got the test plan, and we're reviewing that now. So we're going to test up to 5 different media, resins and this other adsorbent media. So based on that, we're hoping DDW's got to review the test plan and approve it, and then we'll have more competition in getting these.
So you started that in January. When can we expect like a preliminary report on breakthrough? And
yeah, so it'll probably be a while. Hopefully we'll finish reviewing the test plan this week, and then we'll submit it to DDW. Hopefully they turn it around within a month, maybe a little bit less, but so say by the end of May. We'll have it up and running by June, July. We probably won't start getting really any hard data, even though we'll be taking weekly samples until mid-fall.
And which well will be tested?
So we're going to install it at Valley Center. Yeah.
Thank you.
And then we have the wells that are in the construction design phase, which is around 8,000 gallons a minute. And those cost estimates were $41 million. And around $2.5 million for O&M. In the planning phase, we have about 10,200 gallons per minute in planning, various forms of planning, with a cost estimate again around $47 million, 3.9 O&M, and then the additional impacts based on the new MCLs that the EPA has drafted are around 8,300 gallons per minute, $25 million in CIP. And around 2.9 million. So we're looking at a range of about $130 to $160 million total. Again, these are soft numbers. So a lot of them are soft. So we got to take them with a grain of salt. So we did build in a little bit of contingency. And then I wrote some notes here. I think I've already talked about that. The CIP and O&M are based on 2020 actual cost and consultant estimates and recent costs. And that is it in a nutshell, in a longer than 20-minute nutshell.
All right.
And if you have any more questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
All right. Before we get into board questions, I do have a public comment card that I'd like to take before we open up to additional comments, questions. Ms. Noltemeyer, would you please come to the podium and make your public comment on item 7?
Pam Noltemeyer, yes, I would like to refer you to the April 18th, 2023 letter to Los Angeles County Board of Supervisors, and that's from Matthew G. Stone, General Manager. I think that basically says it all, and I'm sure all of you read it. If you didn't, you're way out of touch of what's really going on. Read the letter, then think about what you're doing. And it's not all this jibber jabber. It's much more serious than that. And I noticed that none of you drink the water. We haven't for years. I don't cook with it. We don't drink it. And this is just proof of why you shouldn't either. It's to the Los Angeles County Board of Supervisors, and it's from Matthew G. Stone, General Manager, April 18th, 2023. You should have it in your packet, and hopefully you read it. Then you would know what's going on, and I shouldn't have to draw you a picture. And if you haven't done that, you're being negligent, all of you, down the line. And I sit here time after time on meetings, and I'm just appalled. And when it comes down to this, we don't use your water at all. We buy our water. I cook with it. We drink it. And that's been for years. And this is getting ridiculous, what's going on now. Just read that one letter and you'll know what's going on. And if you haven't read it, why not? And you sure don't act like you know what's going on most things. But it's just irritating to sit through these meetings and then hear that presentation when they really should be referring you to the letters that Matthew G. Stone, General Manager, sent to the Los Angeles County Board of Supervisors. Then you'll find out what's going on. And if you can't do that, then please just step down from whatever you're doing and let someone come on board that will do it. Because it's getting very, very irritating coming to these meetings and seeing the same rhetoric going through on.
Thank you, Ms. Nolte.
Time's up. Good night.
Before that, do we have any public comment online, April?
We do not.
Very good. Director Colley.
I read the letter and other things as well. So appreciate your explaining a lot of this. Question in all of this wonderful alphabet soup that we have, the new alphabet soup, are existing resins able to deal with that as or those things as well? And when they start to be, when they appear and we need to get them out, will our existing treatment plants be able to handle that with the existing resins, or will we have to? I guess my real question is there any possibility we're going to need to put two different vessels in series in order to get some of this garbage out?
Yeah, great question. And I want to reference what Ms. Noltemeyer said. I did neglect to mention that the letter was there, but I did mention that we're required to notify the board, the county, and the city, and a letter is associated with that. If it wasn't for the updates, then it would have just been a letter and I wouldn't be up here. So yes, the short answer, Director Colley, so far is that yes, it is showing that it's removing the long chain PFAS chemicals, which are the ones that are currently being targeted for regulations. There are some short chain. I think PFBS might be a short chain, but the health effects levels that they're proposing are upwards of 200 parts per trillion, and most of our wells don't even have it, or it's low enough to where it's like in the teens or less. So I think we're in good shape with the current media that we have. That's part of the reason why we're doing the pilot, is to see how it will impact. So we're going to test all of them. We're going to test every single PFAS chemical. There's 28. The first laboratory method was 517, and it tested for 18, analyzed for 18. The current method is analyzing for 28. So we'll have more of that information as well. So,
Director Marks.
Mike, on your last slide, do you have dates associated with when you think the additional impacted wells might be brought back online? Or
yeah, that's a great question. We have, as you well know, we have biweekly PFAS strike meetings. We've actually created a sub group to meet weekly for now to talk about planning and bringing back online. We have our water resource team I just met with Sarah yesterday and the day before, and I think maybe the day before that too. No, that would have been Sunday, but I think it was last week. And we're looking at the potential impacts to supply coming in. But the T7, U4, and U6, I believe, is 2024, 2025. S-wells, 2026. And so any of the other ones that were going to be taken offline potentially at the end of this year would be sometime after that, unless we expedite and fast track, which we, skip planning, skip all of that. Let's just do it. We did it once, but I wasn't gray before then. At least my chin wasn't.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Director Peterson.
Just a little bit of question that came to mind after listening to you talk about N13 and some of the other wells. Has the chemicals that we're dealing with the PFAS been involved with the construction or the maintenance of those wells, you think, over the years?
I never really thought about that. We had talked about Teflon tape, mm-hmm. because it would be in Teflon. There are certain requirements for the samplers. They're not allowed to do certain things. They're not allowed to have lotion. They're not allowed to have the rubber gloves. There's certain things that they're required to do before they take a sample to help prevent any of that. So there's possibility that some of the maintenance stuff, but we're also seeing it coming out of the sanitation district effluent. So it's pervasive. We've had firefighting foams throughout this valley. Yeah. Everybody, I don't know, is there anybody in here that doesn't have a Teflon pan? Have you ever? Yeah, exactly. So, it's ubiquitous. It's everywhere. And I sat in on a webinar from EPA, and they're putting a lot of money and a lot of effort into this right now.
Director, Vice President Gutzeit.
Thank you. Terrific presentation and a good refresher. I have a question. My question always is, this is a big deal for this valley. It's a big deal, for some of the Southern California water agencies, but it doesn't seem like it's that big a deal for the whole state. I mean, I don't understand why everybody's not freaking out over this, because we have a good size service area. We have a good, large ability to spread these costs, but there has to be areas of the state where this is worse and far less customers to pay for it. Why are we seeing so much of this? Are there certain areas that haven't had to sample yet, or they're not sampling? Why us and not other areas?
Yeah, other areas are. It's just not attractive to put in the news media, mm-hmm. which is interesting, because when they came out with Dark Waters, which had Mark Ruffalo and Anne Hathaway,
I saw it. It's good.
I remember talking with one of our regulators with DDW saying this is going to be the next Aaron Brockovich. And it didn't. It didn't even last in the movie. So I'm not really sure why it hasn't picked up a lot of steam. We work pretty closely with Orange County. All of their member agencies are getting hit hard. Mm-hmm. Their estimates are, I think he said, I can't remember, but it was up to the $500 million that they're looking at dealing with.
I mean, Central Valley and stuff, are these other, potentially disadvantaged areas having this?
Yeah, I don't know. I got to imagine they are.
It's covering up the PFAS. Other stuff is worse. Yeah.
Yeah. So what Steve just mentioned too, is the UCMR is going to pick up on this. So you got to remember the first UCMR was in the UCMR 3 that we picked up PFAS chemicals was in 2015 timeframe. It missed 2020, but this current one that we're in, 2023 to 25, has all the PFAS chemicals. So the data is coming in. It's just slow.
And it will affect agencies of all sizes.
Yep. Everybody. Okay. Yeah.
And then on a related note, because of these large impacts, are we participating in the MCL process to comment on the impacts to agencies?
Yeah, great question. And I'll go back quickly to your other one. We're not seeing it in the surface water.
Thank goodness.
Right. So we're not seeing it in our imported supplies. But yeah, we are. We have sat in on some webinars. We have a who's the
I can answer that one, Director Goodsay, if you want. Yes, we are weighing in. We've written letters. The preferred approach right now is to make sure that the larger like AQUA, AWWA, there's an AMWA that has our information, cost information mainly of what the impact looks like. Some of the information that came out through the MCL process looked like it wasn't fully capturing what the cost is going to be on this for the nation. So yeah. That's the role we're pushing right now, rather than necessarily getting into whether the health effect stuff is right or wrong. Mm-hmm. We're really focusing in on making sure that they're analyzing the cost, because as Mike pointed out, they take that into account when they're doing the MCL.
Right. Okay. And last thought, because again, this seems like such a big deal for us. Do you have a feel for how many truckloads of this resin we're shipping? I mean, we have all these plants going. I go by the one at the Pony Fields and I see the bags of I'm assuming it's spent resin or new, either way, there's like super sacks lined up. I mean, what is there a large impact on disposal? And, you know, I hope we also comment that, I mean, we're either filling up landfills or incinerating. I think we're incinerating and running a lot of trucks around the country for this. And again, all these water agencies are going to be doing the same thing.
Yeah. Let me try to answer all of that. The super sacks that you see on site, that was a result of we were having some head pressure issues with channeling of the resin and compacting of the resin. So we had one of our resin providers come out and take some scoops out and put it off site. We just got them. They had to run an analysis. So they have to run, I can't remember what it's called, but they have to look at it. They have to profile it, the resin, to make sure it meets everything and what's in it before they take it to wherever they're taking it. So we just got approval for them to get rid of that. So they're going to be moving that. We've only, I say only, in, so it went online the end of 2020. So 2021, 22, for 2 years, we've had three resin change outs at the ball fields. So it's averaging about one change out a year at each location, depending on the number of vessels. So one change out per train of vessels. Yeah. Yeah. No. Yeah.
Are we incinerating?
We are currently incinerating. Yes.
Okay.
Well, we aren't, but
Vice President Ozahoski wanted to make a comment, but I do want to remind the board that we are at the 9 o'clock hour. So I would, ask that we keep things short and try to move things along as quickly as possible. Go ahead, Vice President.
I'll make it quick. So EPA will be holding a public hearing on May 4th regarding the new regulations, and you have to register by April 28th. Second comment, we see it in sanitation waters. Can you send us the lab results from sanitation district on these chemicals? We'd like to see the concentration levels.
Yeah, they're in the, if I remember correctly, about mid-20s for PFOA and PFOS. But I can do that.
Okay, please do.
All right.
And you mentioned that there's a compacting issue in our silos. Is that a big problem right now? Or
no, it was just in one, and it's because it far exceeded what we expected it for bed volumes to pass through. We were expecting around 160,000 bed volumes. It was upwards of 220. So we actually proactively replaced it because we were dealing with head loss.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you. Back to you, President Martin.
Director Armitage, go ahead.
Thank you. Thank you for your presentation. Always appreciate your presentation style. They're very wise in sending you to be the the one who does the hard lift with the darker matter of PFAS. So thank you. I just want to say, I feel like our top obligation to the community is to ensure that our water that we're serving to our community members and our kids are safe and meet regulations. And I know this is a difficult position that everybody kind of in the water world is in as we kind of await the updated regulations. But I just want to repeat what I've said before, that I've always appreciated the very proactive position that you mentioned earlier that the agency has taken on this issue. You mentioned a lot of us weren't on the board when these conversations were started. I was actually in the audience listening to these conversations when they first started. And one of the first thoughts that I had was, I am so thankful as somebody whose kids drink this water that they are being proactive. So I encourage us to continue on that path. And that's why I was asking the questions earlier about like, can we, you know, bring those timing intervals maybe a little closer together, not just for me, for everybody. So I really want to put that out there because that continues to be top of mind for me as we try to struggle with this very massive and very expensive issue. And, you know, I would just say that I know we have a very long CIP list that Mr. Mail reminds us of constantly. But I would like to say that, you know, I think these should be priority projects. I think the safety of our water should be priority. And I would like to see us prioritize that. And I don't know how that affects the CIP project list going forward, hopefully not too much, but I would be open to reprioritizing things to meet the regulations and to make sure that we are very confident when we tell our customers our water is safe and the water your children drink is safe. So just wanted to put that out there. A couple questions really quick. I was deep in thought when you asked your question, Director Colley. So if this is a repeat, tell me it's a repeat. The treatment that we're using for PFOA and PFOS is also going to work on the PFHXS. Is that what you asked? Yeah.
Yes.
And the answer is yes. Yes. Okay. Sorry. Given our last question, given our increase in the state water project allocations, is there wiggle room for some of these wells that maybe have much higher levels of things that we would like to see to maybe be shut down if we're getting increased allocations, at least for this year? I don't know. I'm just trying to understand if there's...
So we're looking at that right now.
Okay.
Like I mentioned, we're having side meetings as opposed, you know, in addition to our normal PFAS strike. And we're working with Sarah Fleury to figure out what we need to operate, what we don't need to operate, and what we can bring in and not bring in. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yep. And sorry for going long.
Director Bronstein.
I'm making this really, really short. I just wanted to to communicate my gratitude to your presentation and to your proactive, and the whole team too, to your proactive approach to this problem. I would like to echo Director Armitage's suggestions that to me, this is a high priority, being able to have a good local sustainable resource. It really was a heavy lifter through the drought. I think it's really important that we make sure that we can rely on this resource. So if we need to prioritize this, I think that's a good idea.
Thank you.
Thank you. We'll close this now, Mike, and thank you very much. Thanks. For the presentation. I can only say that I am happy that we have a capable and committed staff that takes care of this problem from day one and from before day one with the strike team. I'm proud of our staff. Thank you very much. We can move on now to item 8, General Manager's Report on Activities, Projects, and Programs. Mr. Stone.
Okay, I have a brief report. And it was brief before that, so that's okay. I attended the funeral service for our employee, Ray Ramirez, last Wednesday, and just wanted to report there was a good, very large turnout of family, friends, and coworkers from SCB Water, which I hope was meaningful for his family and for our staff as well to be able to be there. Turning to brighter matters, we had an all-staff meeting this morning at the City Activities Center, and at that meeting, we recognized staff members with a range of service from 5 to 30 years, which was kind of neat to see that. We had a sort of lined up where we almost had one of each. So that was a nice cross section through the organization. As part of that meeting, we sometimes do kind of a lightning round thing where we have different staff members at each meeting get up and just talk for 5 or 10 minutes about something that they're working on that's impactful or meaningful for the agency that the rest of the staff may not get to hear about because they don't come to these meetings all the time. They're home resting or they're working a different shift. So just kind of a cross section through things happening. A water master plan update. There was a PFAS update, shorter than this one. A weather whiplash update from Sarah. Cybersecurity update and reminders about cybersecurity, and an outreach update as well, where we got to see our own staff star in that leak video that some of you have probably seen. So that was kind of fun. Speaking of approval limits and the general manager's authority under a purchasing policy, it's funny that you should mention that because it has been coming up lately that we're getting perilously close to the limit on some fairly routine contracts that I sign, which then don't have to come through the board. They're part of our work effort. But that got me thinking recently that the inflationary change from 2018 to now is about 24.6 some odd percent. So sometime this year, I may be back with a question about whether we want to index or make any kind of upward adjustment. I don't really want unlimited authority, but it may help with some things that have customarily been, you know, in the $80,000 to $90,000 range that we're not bothering you with. They're now starting to get over the $100,000 range. So just a note on that. No need to approve at this point. No need to disapprove at this point. It's not an action item. And thank you. That's my report for tonight.
Thank you, Matt. Madam Secretary, any public comment online?
There is not.
Very good. Any comment or question from the board? Thank you, Matt, for your report. Mr. Stone, that is. We can move on to item 9, committee meeting recap report for informational purposes only. There was only one report in your packet, which was the Engineering and Operations Committee. Are there any public comments on that, April?
There is not.
Are there any questions or comments from the board? Seeing none, we can move on to item 10, President's Report. I will try to be very quick to conserve time. Outside of the agency conference and events that are coming up, the AWA 31st Annual Water Symposium held this Thursday, April 20th, at the courtyard by Marriott and Oxnard. There'll be the DCA Alignment Tour being held on April 26th in Sacramento. There'll be the Aqua 2023 Spring Conference. Many of us are attending in Monterey from May 9th to May 11th. The Southern California Water Coalition Quarterly Luncheon will be held April 28th from 12 to 2 p.m. at the Wilson Creek Winery in Temecula. And finally, the State of the County on May 31st, 2023 at 11:30 a.m. that is, at the Hyatt Regency. Upcoming board meetings, there'll be a regular board meeting in this room on May 2nd and May 16th. Upcoming committee meetings held at Summit Circle and the ESS Boardroom. April 20, Public Outreach and Legislation. May 4, Engineering and Operations. May 17, Rescheduled Water Resources and Watershed Committee. And May 18, Public Outreach and Legislative Committee. Upcoming meetings at the Rio Vista Water Treatment Plant will be the May 15th Finance and Administration Committee meeting. And that concludes the President's Report. Do we have any public comment?
We do not.
Do we have any questions or comments from the board? Seeing none, thank you. We can move on to item 11, AB 1234 reports. There was one report that was posted on the SCD website and emailed to each of us and on your spots. Does anyone have an additional AB 1234, Vice President Ozahowski?
On April 10th, I had my virtual one-on-one with General Manager Matt Stone. We did talk about the MCL limits and the EPA proposed water regulations.
We'd also discuss the expectations of the new government affairs position at SCV Water. And most importantly, we talked about how the agency handles past legacy drawings and manuals, and how the agency will handle future documents and drawings that will become legacy. Back to you, President Martin.
Director Marks.
Yes, on March 28th and April 4th, I participated in a phone conference call with Aaron Heasley as follow-up to the agency's team-building efforts.
Very good. And the other AB 1234 is Vice President Guzay.
I did not do an AB 1234 report, but I did also have two calls with Aaron Hasty as a follow-up to the board team building. I will get you the dates, April. I couldn't look it up fast enough.
That'd be great. Thank you. I've got the first date. I just need that second one.
Okay.
Director Bronstein.
Well, I did not realize that we needed to report on that one. So I will get you the dates for that too, April. I'm sorry. However, since I wasn't here last time, March 29th, I also participated in the United Water Conservation Tour. And aside from it just being an incredible sight, seeing Lake Piru and that massive river and the spillage, that was amazing to see so much water in Southern California. It was also really fascinating to see what kind of things they deal with down the river and the different innovations that they have and ways that they're dealing with stuff. And it was also nice to meet new people and make new friends.
Director Armitage.
Thank you. I mean, I also met with Aaron virtually twice, but I wasn't going to charge ask for a stipend from them. So do I still need to provide that information to you, Aunt April?
No, only if you're required. Okay. If you're going to put in for a stipend.
Then I'm good. Thank you.
Any other AB 1234s? Director Colley.
Yeah, I also had short phone calls with Aaron. I would personally think that was something that just an extension of a stipend I already received. And so I didn't and plan to and won't be putting in for a stipend for those two short phone calls.
Okay. I don't see any further AB 1234s. Do we have any public comment on the AB 1234s?
We do not.
Very good. Thank you. We can move on to item 12, closed session. We will be going into closed session. The public may stay on the Zoom webinar. Any board members or staff that are connected to the Zoom and are in closed session, please disconnect from Zoom. We will meet in closed session to discuss item 12.1, conference with legal counsel, initiation of litigation pursuant to paragraph 4 of subdivision D of section 54956.9. One case, member of the public and any staff may stay on the current line. And once closed session is over, the board will reconnect to Zoom to the Zoom webinar for closed session announcements and the remaining items on the agenda. We will now take a very brief 5-minute recess while we get the doors closed and get the room set up for closed session. We are now in recess. All right, we are back in open session following the closed session discussions. We can pass it to Mr. Bunn, item 13, closed session announcements.
Mr. President.
Did we need to call the roll for attendance? No? Okay.
No, we did not.
Sorry, Mr. Bunn.
Mr. President, the board met in closed session to discuss the item listed on the agenda and no reportable action was taken.
Very much. We can move on to item 14, director requests for future agenda items. Are there any requests for future agenda items? Director Ozhusky.
I would like to see the finance committee explore a GoFundMe ability for ratepayer assistance.
Okay, got that. Is that an agenda item or just an action you're requesting?
We're requesting an action to be explored by the Finance and Administration Committee.
Doesn't sound like that needs to be an agenda.
I think staff are very similar.
All right. Thank you.
Okay. All right. Any other requests? Good. Seeing none, do we have any public comment on what was said by Director Ozahosky?
We do not. Is this something that we would add to the minutes? Since it's going to, it's already been requested and Bethany is going to take care of it. Would you want to add it to the minutes?
Okay.
Sure.
Okay.
Please do.
All right. Then we have reached item 15, adjournment. Thank you all for hanging in past the witching hour. Sorry for the long meeting, but we are hereby adjourned. Thank you very much.